is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
McCoy at the 10, at the 5, into the end zone. Touchdown! What a great run! He's in trouble. He is dropped. Kyle Williams dropped it. Oh, baby, what a hit. Tyrod looks. Tyrod on the run. Nobody in front of him. Touchdown! There's T-Mobile.
He gonna come through.
Sammy in the end zone. Got it! Got it! Touchdown! Sammy Watkins, touchdown, Buffalo! McCoy, touch to the right. Outrunning everybody. 10, 5, touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown, Buffalo!
Live from One Bills Drive, this is the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts.
Welcome to the John Murphy Show. Chris Brown here on a Thursday edition, along with Marlon Kerner. And Marlon, welcome. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
How are we doing?
I'm doing good.
So we've got a lot on the table today, and we'll get into just what all of that entails. But just for those that aren't familiar, Marlon is with the organization now on a full-time basis, has been for a while, actually. And I don't know how many people remember the career, but I do because I covered part of it, or all of it, actually. Former cornerback. Were you a third or a fourth-round pick?
Third-round pick.
Third-round pick out of Ohio State. And that was when cornerbacks were coming down the pipeline from Columbus to Buffalo on a regular basis. Antoine was already here. Nate came after you.
Antoine and Nate both came after me.
Yeah. So, you know, you look at you kind of started the pipeline, man.
Well, I guess you could say that.
Yeah.
It was interesting coming out of college and not knowing how that process was going to work. And, you know, I had no clue that Buffalo was even interested in drafting me. It was kind of one of those things where I thought I was going to go to Denver. They had been in contact with me the most, but they didn't have a draft pick on the first day.
Yeah.
And I remember my pro day. You know, I had my fastest 40. I ran a 4.35, and Joey Galloway runs a 4.17. So I'm like, thanks, Joey.
Yeah.
Here I am thinking I can move fast, and I got to cover guys like you. So it was kind of interesting. We get the draft day, and they were just like, you know, you can go anywhere from 3 to 5. That was kind of the prediction of where I will fall. And so, you know, my first day was just to watch the draft and watch my friends get drafted that day. So Joey Galloway went, I think, 7 overall.
Yeah, his first round pick.
We had a lot of guys get drafted on that first day. And, you know, I just happened to get ready. I barbecued. I hung out with family and friends. And the next thing I know, I get a phone call. Actually, my cousin, who was the same age as I am, was on the phone. And we were like, do not be on the phone. And she yells up from the basement, like,
yeah, because there's a phone call. We're still talking about house phones now.
Right.
No cell phones.
No cell phones. And so she's like, I'm like, who's on the phone? Like, I didn't hear the phone ring. It's some guy from the Buffalo Bills. And I was like, okay. I get on the phone, and it's Dwight Adams. And he's just saying, Marlon Kerner, you know, congratulations, you're a Buffalo Bill.
Yeah.
And the rest is history. I get here, and I come in, and I play as a rookie, and come in and end up starting, I think, 6 or 7 games that my rookie year with the injury to Jeff Burris. But our secondary was loaded. I was drafted with Ken Irvin, but you also had Jeff Burris and Thomas Smith at the corners,
Smith, right?
Henry Jones, Kurt Schultz at the safeties. They had just signed Bryce Pop. So it was an interesting time to come in. You still had Bruce. Cornelius Bennett was still here. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that defense was amazing. Tet Washington's first year was 1995 as well. So good time to come in, and we knew the ball had to come up fast. So it was a big learning experience, and Dick Roach was our defensive back coach, and he taught us the mirror and roll technique, which if you couldn't do the technique, you couldn't play for him.
And you want to talk about an old school guy. That was an old school guy in every sense of the word. But now you are Director of Player Engagement and Alumni, and I think it's worth shedding some light on just what that entails, because your role kind of expanded here in the offseason with the new coaching staff coming in.
Correct. It started out, I came back in 2015 just as the alumni director, and really just kind of wanted to kind of bring a former player back to kind of really have that contact that they can call and say, hey, I need tickets, I need this, I need that. And so we kind of started trying to build that department. And then it turned into, once we got a new coaching staff, they decided to make more changes. Spoke with Sean McDermott many a times, and his vision for that director of player engagement, and how he wanted to look. He also wanted to be a former player. He had heard about my story and what I had gone through, and the double ACL and
mm-hmm.
the 6 knee surgeries total, and transitioning out from the game. And he wanted somebody to bring that different perspective to that player engagement role, somebody who could relate to guys and understand what they're going through, understanding when family comes and they've got their hand out and saying, I need this and I need that. So really what we do now is we really try to educate our players. You're there for them. You kind of make sure that they can focus on football because there's so many different distractions that come up from being a professional athlete. It's not just people coming at you trying to, I got this great business deal. You know, it's your family. It's your mom, your brother, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins. They're all coming at you. You know, it's amazing. I always ask guys, like, how many people have you talked to in your family that you hadn't talked to probably since you were a kid, since you got drafted? And they all raise their hand like, oh, I've got so many aunts and uncles that I haven't seen in 20 years.
Coming out of the
There's
woodwork.
A reason. So we just try to make sure we give them great guidance. We did a financial literacy week. We talked about credit. We talked about what to look for in financial advisors. We talk about some of the league mandated topics, dealing with mental health, mental toughness, how to budget your time, really. I mean, because that's the biggest thing. How do you budget all your time? Because your practice, you've got so many other obligations and responsibilities, and how do you manage that?
Now, I know the rookies had to stay a week after minicamp. Is this all the stuff you're referring to now, or is that separate?
That was part of it. What we decided to do last year, they did 2 weeks after you had to cram everything in, and I thought that really wasn't enough time to really go in depth and detail with some of those topics. So we were able to start when the rookies got here. So May 15th when they came, we kept them, and then we kind of went an hour a day and just covered topics. And, of course, there were certain times when we'd say, hey, you know what, we're not going to cover anything today. We did a bonding because I think sometimes what's always lost on teams are you have to get to know the guys that you're going to play with to understand who they are, kind of build that camaraderie so that you can understand when I need to run through a brick wall. If I can look to my left and look to my right, you know, I know that guy very well. I can't let him down. So we did a movie day we just went to the movies, saw Baywatch. So that was
how
one thing
showing.
How
did we come up with that choice?
The only movie showing at the time we were able to go.
Right.
So we went to go see Baywatch. Turned out to be kind of funny, but about 12 of us went and just really got to know each other and hang out. And it was early on when the guys got here. So it was a good time to just kind of get that bonding going. And then we just spent the rest of the season the off season kind of getting to know each other, going through practices, really helping them understand, like, hey, you know what? You're a professional now. You know, you're no longer on scholarship. Scholarship time is over. You know, you're getting paid for this. So understand there are certain things that you need to be able to do. You've got to learn how to study and study well, and then also be able to translate that back onto the field, and then be able to budget everything else that's going to come your way. You know, and everybody does all the financial stuff, but guys don't start getting paid until September. So, you know, we talked about what this was going to look like, how we're going to talk about finances to kind of set you up. But then we're going to have follow-up once the season starts because, you know, you don't start getting paid until week two. And that's a lot to try to give that guy to say, hey, remember that stuff we talked about in May, in June? Remember your budgeting processes and make sure you can do that and go. So we just make sure we want to do the follow-up for them once the season starts.
So coming up on the show, and, you know, we've got a lot of interesting stuff here with respect to NFL rosters, and we're going to kind of dovetail off in a few different directions with respect to that. And that's why at 1 o'clock we're going to have CBS Sports' Jamie Eisenberg with us to kind of break down the fantasy angle of rosters in the NFL. But where we want to start today is with NFL rosters in general, because this is the time of year where, for all intents and purposes, with a few exceptions, rosters are all but set for training camp. Obviously, there'll be a lot of changes once training camp rolls around due to injury or people that just don't look like a fit, and we'll see transactions all over the place. But for now, rosters are in place and rosters are set, and it's time where rosters get reviewed, analyzed, picked over, and assessed. And ESPN.com recently did a rundown, a ranking, if you will, of the best rosters in the NFL. And we'll get to that in a second, but when I took a look at the list, and I know you've looked at it too, Marlon, I said to myself, well, is there going to be a roster better that's ranked higher than the Patriots roster? Because that's the team that won the Super Bowl last year, number one. And then number two, they didn't only reload, they upgraded in the offseason with some free agent acquisitions, along with some draft choices and other ways of acquiring some talent via trade like Brandon Cooks. So you look at their roster and you're like, my goodness. I mean, you just won the Super Bowl and the greatest comeback ever in that game, and now you've probably upgraded your roster in several areas. So the question we're posing here at the outset is there a better roster, top to bottom, in the NFL right now than the New England Patriots? If you think there is one, We'd like to know. 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. I think there are some rosters in the league that can give the Patriots roster a run for its money from top to bottom. You want to talk about specific positions, you know, it's probably a little bit tougher. But all the way through the roster, yes, they did fill some holes or some question mark areas for them. Cornerback with Stephon Gilmore. Then they swapped people for certain spots. You know, LeGarrette Blount out, Mike Gillisley in. They also signed Rex Burkhead from Cincinnati. And then obviously the trade to get a true number one wide receiver, something they've really haven't had since Randy Moss was running routes for them in 07, 08. You really never had a number one wideout when you think about it.
No, and it's amazing what Tom Brady has been able to do with kind of piecemeal guys, kind of guys that maybe other teams discarded, guys that teams thought, yeah, you know, he's not a good fit. I mean, you look at what Chris Hogan did, and, you know, we called him 7-11 for a reason. I mean, the guy, all he does is get open. He runs great, precise routes. And then you put him in that system, and he thrives. You know, and then all of a sudden, now we look like the bad guys because we can't keep him. I mean, and they get a guy that now is a true burner in Brandon Cooks. You add him with Wes Welker. You add him with all the guys you have out there. Not Welker, sorry, but you add him with all the guys you have. Edelman, Amendola. Now you've got another weapon, and you still have Gronk out there. And then I think the biggest thing they did was their defense. I mean, you know, you go and get – you might have one of the top two cornerbacks tandems in the NFL now with what they have in Butler and Stephon. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. And, oh, they just came off of winning the Super Bowl. So is it even fair of what they're able to do? But, you know, that's what good organizations do. They go and look and say, how can we get better? We go target guys we have. And luckily for them, they were able to go out and get the guys they wanted. Now, that's on paper. The question is can they go and come together and put it all together on the field and go after another Super Bowl championship? That's what they're chasing.
Right. And I think there was one acquisition that kind of went under the radar, and it was the acquisition of Coney Ealy at the defensive end position. They pull him out of Carolina, and – you know, there's another guy that they can sit on the edge there. And I think the other thing that kind of went by the board was they held on to Malcolm Butler when all indications were they were going to trade him. They keep him in the fold, and they also keep Dante Hightower in the fold, which I think a lot of people thought was going to price himself out of New England with his contract demands. And in the end, they get that done. So even the pieces that were up and headed to free agency or were rumored to be traded, including Garoppolo, stayed put,
right,
you know, for another season. So I think a lot of people are finding it hard to find a better roster top to bottom in the NFL than the Patriots. I think from a pure talent perspective, there are rosters that can hang with what New England has put together. And we can address the list by ESPN.com. The thing that bothers me is there are some rosters on this rankings list where I'm really scratching my head a little bit. And I guess it's to be anticipated. It's very subjective. It's opinion-based in terms of ranking these rosters, although you look at the one that they put together, and they were trying to use numbers through Pro Football Focus and some of the rankings there of the individual players and then basically saying who's got some of the best numbers collectively. Here's one that I think they nailed. Oakland Raiders at six, sixth best roster in the league. You've got one of the best pass rushers in football in Khalil Mack. You've got one of the best young quarterbacks in Derek Carr. You've got a monster offensive line. And you just upgraded your secondary because you drafted Gary and Conley. And I think they added a guy in free agency who's slipping my mind right now. So they've got – they knew they had holes in the secondary, and they've tried to effectively plug them. Now, Gary and Conley is very unproven. I know you probably watched him a lot being a being a Buckeye alum. But I think what they've done with the young talent on hand – I think that's a fitting area for them because they, you know, Amari Cooper, Michael Crabtree, you know, you've got talent there. And I think you've also got some good defensive talent, some premier defensive talent at the most important position, you know, most people would argue, defensive end. So in Mac. So I like where they sat the Raiders at six. I think the Cowboys at seven is fair. That's fair. I mean, the offensive line is the linchpin. Obviously, when you have two rookies in your offensive backfield that light the world on fire as rookies, that certainly helps your ranking with the way they performed. So I thought that was good. They had the Chargers at eight. Now, the Chargers do have talent.
Yes.
I just think it's largely underachieved when you think about it. Melvin Ingram, really good pass rusher, has battled injuries. Joey Bosa flies off the stat sheet this year, last year as a rookie, and looks like he's going to be a big-time player as a defensive end. The offensive line is what's been the problem for the Chargers. They can't keep it healthy, but they draft two young guards in the draft to fortify the interior of that offensive line. And, you know, you got some underrated players there on the corners. Casey Hayward, Jason Verrett. I mean, you got some good corners there. I think there's good talent. Melvin Gordon. I mean, Melvin Gordon in an Anthony Lynn offense, he might run for 1,800 yards this year.
He's going to have a monster season, and I would agree with you. I think they probably got ranked high, and probably just because of the fact that you look on paper. Again, and this is subjective just because it's paper. So, yes, when you look at the draft picks that they have, when you look at what they were able to do and the new coaching staff that's coming in, there's optimism. I don't know if they should be ranked that high because they haven't produced. I mean, they're mediocre at best. I mean, and they always have just injuries. Now, you do have Rivers, who always performs, always puts up great numbers, great fantasy quarterback to have. I had him on my team last year, and he helped put up some good numbers for me. But outside of that, I mean, you know, when it comes on a crunch time, those guys can't get it done in November and December when it counts. So they can start off great and put up numbers and score a lot of points, but they always find a way to implode. They always have a key injury somewhere late in the season, and then it impacts them for the rest of it, and they can't make that run and make that final push. So it's going to be interesting to see how that offense performs. More importantly, it's going to be interesting to see if their defense can stay consistent throughout the season to kind of help get them over the hump, because they gave up a lot of points toward the end of the last season when their defense needed to step up and make plays. They couldn't make plays.
There was another team ranked right behind them that I thought was ranked awfully high, especially considering the losses they incurred in terms of proven players. Kansas City Chiefs were ranked 9th best roster in the league. I mean, their quarterback is a middle-of-the-road quarterback at best in Alex Smith. They lost Dontari Poe, didn't bring him back. Their middle linebacker, Derek Johnson, is trying to come back from an Achilles injury. He's 34. Jamaal Charles isn't there anymore. He's in Denver trying to reclaim his status as a capable NFL back after another knee injury. And Jeremy Maclin just went out the door. So now they still have a game breaker in Travis Kelce, maybe one of the best two or three tight ends in the league. I don't deny that for a second. Tyreek Hill is an exciting player, but now he's a number one receiver. Can he handle that role? And, you know, your running back position is still a little bit of a mixed bag now that has to fill the void of Charles. So how are they a top 10 roster in the NFL?
That's Andy Reid. I think what you look at there is they've always shown that they can be a plug-and-play type of coaching staff, and they can go in and take any player, plug them in, and then that team always becomes successful. I think you're holding on to the fact that their defense is still going to be pretty good, and you've got consistency at the quarterback. And as long as you have consistency at the quarterback position, and he's not going to turn the ball over, he's not going to force it, he's going to make smart decisions, they're okay with how they play. They don't mind playing that old school sometimes, 2 yards in a cloud of dust, we'll run the ball, we'll do some play action passes, we'll punt it, and we'll let our defense kind of win games for us. So you're going to see a lot of relying on their defense to really get them out of situations.
And their secondary is great.
Their secondary is great.
You got Barry. You know, you got Peters back there. I mean, there's some Pro Bowl talent in the secondary,
right?
No question about it.
And that's what you're going to look at. You're going to say, okay, our defense, as long – kind of like Baltimore back in that 2000 when they had that great run, just don't turn the ball over. Don't put our defense in bad situations. And they're going to figure out a way to get a turnover for us. They're going to get an interception, a fumble. Something is going to give that our defense is going to step up and make a play. And then that means we're going to have a short field, and we're just going to be smart and take care of the football and don't do anything silly to put our defense in a bad situation.
803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Is there a better roster in the NFL right now than the New England Patriots? It's our Twitter poll today. It's a simple yes or no answer. And if you have one that you believe is better, give us a call, let us know, and tell us why. But right now, it's a rather lopsided Twitter poll. 80% of our respondents are saying no, there is not a better roster right now than the Patriots. Do you think some of that is a little slanted in the way it is, not only because they won the Super Bowl, but because of who they have as a head coach? I think the coaching acumen also factors into some of this thinking here, because like we were saying, this was a team devoid of a true number one wide receiver until this year with Brandon Cooks from the time Randy Moss was there in 2007, 2008. Now they have a number one again, but for the last 7, 8 years, they did not have a true number one wide receiver, and yet were one of the best passing teams in football. And some people will chalk that up to Brady. Some people will chalk that up to the coaching and the design of the offense. Whatever way you want to slice it, the bottom line is you're getting ranked as a great roster, but you don't have that top-end talent at the wide receiver position. It seems to just go by the board. When you have a host of other teams with true number ones, you know, Julio Jones in Atlanta, or, you know, name your receiver here, Amari Cooper in Oakland or whatever.
Dez Bryant in Dallas.
Yeah. So to me, that's why I'm a little surprised that it's as lopsided as it is. Of course, we are in Buffalo, and we hate everything New England naturally.
We can't stand New England, right. I think it does go toward the fact that you do have Belichick, and Belichick just, for whatever reason, they make what they have work. It doesn't matter what player it is. They don't have to be true number ones. It's, can you fit into our scheme and our system? So they do an amazing job of making sure. They're probably the best team that I've ever seen really come in and tailor their offense and their game plan and the design of the plays that they run to the talent that they have on the roster. So it's going to be very interesting to see on paper what they can do when you have a true burner in Brandon Cooks, and then you also have all the route runners you have, and if you can get a healthy Gronk to come back and be healthy for an entire season, and then kind of see what that defense can do now, because now you have two corners that can really lock up number one and number two. Do you see a lot more blitzing out of this defense? Do you see them really try to get more pressure through design of blitz and zone blitzes, because you have corners that can play both off and can play up? And so you have safeties that can come in. Can you blitz your corners? You've got good size at the cornerback position, size at the safety position. You've got your linebacker that can come in and do so many different things. And now you're looking like, great. I mean, you took the team that came back with the greatest comeback ever in Super Bowl history, and now they're loaded. Their roster's loaded. They have pass rushers on both sides of the ball, on both edges. So it's going to be very interesting to see. And so teams are like, who's going to beat them? Who's going to beat them now?
Right.
Atlanta? Because, we saw Atlanta have a chance.
And I understand why, because before they loaded up with all this talent, they won the Super Bowl.
Right.
Now they've got more talent, and so I think people think meshing that with high-end coaching acumen and schemes, and, oh, by the way, one of the best quarterbacks to ever play the game, that they're just going to sail through the season. I suppose that's possible. I don't want to admit it, but I suppose that's possible. But we want to know, if there's a better roster out there, in your opinion, give us a call, 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. We'll go to the phones, and leading us off here is Joe on a sell. Joe, what do you got for us? You got a better team than the Patriots in terms of roster talent, top to bottom?
Yeah, the team that they lost to in the Super Bowl. I mean, the Falcons were up 25 points before some questionable coaching decisions that led to a colossal meltdown. I mean, you got the New York Giants, who vastly improved their defense, and they added Brandon Marshall and Jamal Charles. That you put Bill Belichick on the Jaguars, you have a ton of young, talented players. The Patriots have mediocre to good players at best on that roster that they, because of great coaching, are able to put them together, get the best out of them, and win games.
Okay, so your vote is Falcons better than Patriots. Anybody else, or is that it?
Who was that?
Anybody else, or just the Falcons is your pick to be ranked higher than Patriots?
I think the Falcons are better. Take away coaching, pure talented on rosters.
Yeah.
The Jaguars are a young, good team. Yeah. The Colts, Giants. There's some firepower out there that they just need to put together and plan it, the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Right, and that, unfortunately, is where, you know, we've seen the coaching make a difference up in New England. I mean, the guy really just knows how to get the most out of what he has at his disposal. But we appreciate the call, Joe. 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. And Joe's pick is a good one, because on the list on ESPN.com, the Atlanta Falcons were chosen as the number one roster in the NFL. New England was number two on the list. And I would tend to agree with it. I think from a pure talent perspective, Atlanta's got more. They've got Julio Jones, who I would take over Brandon Cooks in a heartbeat. They have one of the fastest defenses in the NFL. They've got an MVP candidate, a quarterback in Matt Ryan. You look at the speed that they have on the defensive side of the ball. They've got two good running backs. I just think they have the whole package in terms of top to bottom type talent. So, and their offensive line is good. So, you know, to me, I think that the whole thing rolled together, I think Atlanta's roster is superior, and it and they probably should have won that game. But when you only run it five times, up 20-something points in the second half, you're playing right into the hands of what New England likes to do.
He brought up the Giants.
Yeah, I was a little puzzled by that one. Yes, they did kind of reload, but they did it with some aging veterans like Brandon Marshall, for example. Now, he doesn't have to play the number one role, obviously, in that Giants receiving core. He can be a complement to Odell Beckham Jr. And it's interesting the approach that the Giants have taken in recent years, because the Giants historically have been known as a build-through-the-draft type team. They are one of the most patient teams in football in terms of letting their draft choices develop. A draft pick could stink his first 2 years with the Giants.
Yes.
They'll stick with him.
Yes,
they
will.
Hang on to them and wait until year three, see if they're ready to start by even year four. Extraordinarily patient with their draft choices, and more often than not for them it pays off. But Jerry Reese, the GM there, has really kind of flipped the script in terms of building that roster. They've been heavy participants in free agency each of the last couple of years. I think the purpose there is to try to squeeze out maybe a couple of more playoff runs with Eli Manning still
right.
as the quarterback, knowing he's getting on in years himself.
I mean, that's the guy who you have to look at when you talk about the Giants. I mean, yes, they did do some great things. They upgraded their roster, but it all rolls through Eli. And from my experience of just watching him, you don't know which Eli you're going
to
get from week in and week out. I mean,
if
your line is playing great, you're going to get an Eli who can put up great numbers. But if you can get pressure and get him off the mark and get his feet, get those happy feet going, Eli will turn the ball over at an enormous rate. He'll give you 2, 3, 4 interceptions in the game. So it all comes down to, can your offensive line protect him? If their offensive line has great play all season long, then you'll see Eli put up great numbers. If they can take some of the pressure off of him and get another compliment to Beckham, then he doesn't have to hold the ball as long. I mean, but
yeah.
You have the talent on one side. Now it's, can Brandon Marshall be that true number two, take some of the pressure off, get some double teams so you can get Beckham singled up 101. You've got some young guys that can come out there and play as well. So
Sterling Shepard can sit in the slot then.
Yes.
If Marshall can play outside. And now you've got three pretty good weapons there. So that could work really well for them. You know, I think you look at their running back situation, it's a real mixed bag. You know, I know they have high hopes for Paul Perkins, the UCLA product, who's, I think, in his second year now. And Shane Vereen is still there, but has been largely a disappointment since he got there in free agency from New England. And they drafted Wayne Gallman in the fourth round out of Clemson. Not a speed guy by any means, but it's just a mixed bag back there. There's no true guy that's going to be on the field more than anybody else. You kind of have your passing down guy, and I think they hope Perkins can become their feature back. Obviously, their defensive ends are first class. I mean, I don't know. You may not be able to find too many better tandems than Jason Pierre-Paul and Olivier Vernon, who since coming over in free agency has really kind of turned it on for them from a pass-rushing perspective. And then their secondary is young and talented. I mean, Eli Apple, Landon Collins, Darian Thompson, Janoris Jenkins, that is a good group.
Janoris Jenkins,
so,
I mean, he can flat-out play.
So initially, I'm sitting here looking at the ESPN rankings list saying, oh, they ranked him 16th. You know, I was thinking, well, that might be a couple of spots higher than I would have had him. But when you look at their roster top to bottom, it's not bad.
It's
Snacks
not bad
Harrison, you know, defensive
right.
tackle. So I think 16 is probably right, maybe even a notch or two
higher. Maybe 14, 13
yeah.
range, just off of what they have talent-wise. But, again,
question
marks at running back position.
Right.
And that, if you can't run the ball in this league, that puts a lot of pressure on your quarterback. And when your quarterback has to be a one-man show, we've seen what Eli can do. He'll turn the ball over. He either plays great or he goes the opposite way. There's no middle ground with him. There's no, hey, you know what, I'll bounce back off of this. It's really he has a great game when there's pressure, or he has a terrible game when there's pressure at him.
Is there a better roster top to bottom in the NFL than the New England Patriots? We already had a call. Joe said, yeah, it's Atlanta. ESPN.com agrees with him with their roster rankings for 2017. What do you think? 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550, the number to get on board. Corey on a cell, hang on. You'll be first after the break. as we step aside momentarily here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Back on the John Murphy Show, Chris Brown along with Marlon Kerner here on a Thursday edition of the program. Coming up at 1 o'clock, CBS Sports' Jamie Eisenberg as we take more of a fantasy look at NFL rosters across the league. But right now, we're discussing best rosters in terms of pure talent. And is there one better than the New England Patriots right now? Our Twitter poll is indicating most of you think no, but we do have some dissenting opinions on the line. And we'll get to those in just a second. You know, the first caller we had today, he mentioned the Falcons is having a better roster. ESPN.com agreed they had the Falcons as the best roster, top to bottom, in the league heading into 2017. A lot of top-end talent, a lot of depth, and I would tend to agree. I think it is a better roster, top to bottom, than even the Patriots roster is right now. The other team that he mentioned, though, I found very interesting. He mentioned the Jacksonville Jaguars, and people say, the Jaguars, well, what have they done? Well, they haven't done a lot in terms of wins and losses, and a good amount of that is tied to their quarterback play. But you look at the talent they've acquired, not only in free agency the last 2 years, but the talent they've acquired in the draft. I mean, all you have to say is Jalen Ramsey and Leonard Fournette right off the top, and it's just like, okay. Those are two future playmakers in this league, if not current playmakers. They've got the all-SEC backfield with Leonard Fournette and T.J. Yeldon. I think the offensive line really is their only weakness, but that defense is going to do some damage this year, or it should.
It should. They should definitely play lights out, and they're young, and I think that's the thing. Young, hungry, and sometimes don't know. They don't know better of where they should be and how they should play. So they just believe they can come in here, put in the work, and go out there and win games. And that's dangerous. Yeah. Again, it always comes back to quarterback play in this league. And Blake Bortles, what Blake Bortles are you going to get? Are you going to get a guy that can go through and throw 3-4 touchdowns a game and keep his turnovers to the minimum? Or are you getting a guy who throws more interceptions than he does touchdowns in an NFL season? And he's had some success. He's had some not-so-great seasons. And that's always going to be the play. It always comes back to him. And they stuck with him. So hopefully what they've done, bringing in Coughlin and kind of looking at saying, okay, how can we make this young guy better? How can we surround him with more talent? Can we take the load? You've got two great running backs. I don't think I'm going to ask him to put the game on his arm and say, okay, you go throw the ball 50 times and go win it for us. They're going to go pound the ball. They've got two guys that can run the ball. One, Yeldon's already proven that he can play in this league. And Fournette, if he looks like anything that he did when he was at LSU, they're going to have a great 1-2 punch. And you can take your pick which one is the number one back. You can go 1A, 1B with those two guys and just say they're going to see the ball a lot. They're going to hand the ball off a lot. And once you can get a great ground game going, play action becomes your friend. And now Bortles with the big arm. I think you might see some success with him this season.
803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. If you think there's a roster out there better top to bottom than that of the New England Patriots, ESPN.com says there is one. It's the Falcons. Let us know if you think there's another at 803-0550. We go to the phones, and as promised, to Corey on a cell leading us off here in this segment. Corey, what do you have for us in terms of a roster?
Well, you may think I'm crazy, but the Buffalo Bills.
Better than the Patriots?
Think about this. Honestly, think about this. You have the best, one of the best offenses in the league. The rushing is number one back-to-back.
Okay.
You have LeSean McCoy. Now, one thing about the Buffalo Bills is that they are known for having great running backs. They can take anybody off the streets and just get them. You had Carlo Williams last year, which he messed up. He was a good accusation. He could run and stuff. We had Mike Geesley, who was with the Miami Dolphins, now with the Bills, but now went to the Patriots. We had once, remember, way back, not so long ago, we had Marshawn Lynch, Fred Jackson, and C.J. Spiller. So think about that.
I am thinking about that, but they're not on the roster now, Corey.
I know, but
I'm sorry to cut you off. We got to get to other calls, but I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around your opinion there. I'm going to respectfully disagree. The Bills just aren't there yet in terms of roster building. especially when you consider the fact that they've kind of hit the reset button under Sean McDermott. So while I think you can pick spots where the Bills are superior position-wise, I mean, I would take LeSean McCoy over any running back that the Patriots have right now. But collectively, the depth that they offer there is probably superior to McCoy and everybody else that's here in Buffalo. You have guys on that team with time in the league, proven numbers, and with the Bills, you've got McCoy and a bunch of guys.
Right.
And so even though McCoy is certainly the best of the bunch between those two rosters, the depth behind him is unproven, and therefore, you know, if you're going to say top to bottom on your roster, you're talking first string, second string, third string, they've got him beat at running back probably. And then quarterback, I don't think we have to discuss that.
Defense, secondary. I mean, you're missing your starting cornerback.
Wide receiver, they've got more proven options there. You can argue Watkins versus Cooks. I'm good with that. But past that, you know, your number two is it's either Andre Holmes or Zay Jones. It's an unproven rookie or a guy that could not get up to number three on the depth chart in Oakland. So, you know, Chris Hogan, Danny Amendola, Malcolm Mitchell. I mean, I just think the depth is there.
Definitely.
To a superior degree. And then on defense, I don't think the Bills may have him on the defensive line, and if so, it's not by a whole lot. And then linebacker, I think New England is vastly superior there across the board.
Across the board.
You know, so because, again, you've got another unproven guy in Reggie Ragland. He certainly comes in with high credentials and high expectations, but the proof's in the pudding, and we haven't seen that yet after he lost his rookie season to the ACL injury. So I just don't think they're there. Now, what I will say is I think the Bills roster on this rankings list by ESPN did the Bills a little bit of a disservice. I think they are ranked extraordinarily low, probably lower than they should have been. They've got them ranked 27th. You think it should be higher than that?
Definitely should be higher than that. I think just looking at the talent that you have and the run game and where we led in our offensive line being intact and coming back. So you would think that they would still be up there in the league leaders in rushing. And I know they're going to say, well, you lost Mike Gillisley. Okay, I get that. But this is a great opportunity for a young Jonathan Williams to come in and show that he's ready to take the reins and be the number two. And so I think you have a great opportunity there. And yes, do we have questions in the secondary? We absolutely do. We lost our starting cornerback to our division rival, New England Patriots. So who's going to step up? Is it going to be Tre'Davious White coming in with the first-round draft pick, or will Kevon Seymour step up and say, hey, you know what, not so fast, rookie. You know, I've got a year underneath your belt, and I'm going to come in here and show you that I can be the starter in the secondary. There's questions there. There's no questions with New England secondary. They know what they have. They took our starting Pro Bowl cornerback and made him the right cornerback and right cornerback, and he's starting there, and he's going to tandem with Butler. And so now you've got a great 1-2 punch there. Their safeties are already set. McCourty, he can play. Chung, he can play. So we have too many question marks on our roster and our secondary.
It's unproven. Unproven.
And that's
especially
why they're
at linebacker. I mean, Preston Brown and Reggie Ragland are going to hash it out at middle linebacker in training camp. You know, and whoever doesn't win that job is probably going to be one of the other starting spots, presumably strong side, knowing Preston has experience there and Ragland is one of the biggest linebackers on the roster, you know, at 250 pounds. So I think it's a situation where you have people to put in those roles, but how proven are they in the league? They aren't. In the vast majority of them aren't anyway. And so I think that's what hurts Buffalo's ranking, but I would not have them 27th. You have a Pro Bowl fullback in Pat DeMarco. You've got a Pro Bowl running back in LeSean McCoy. Here's an interesting number that Pro Football Focus had in the Bills ranking. Tyrod Taylor had a passer rating of 80.1 under pressure. That ranked 6th in the league last year. It's one spot behind Brady, and Taylor ranked 5th in 2015. So that's a strength of his game in terms of passing under pressure, which may come as a surprise to some people. But I just think 27th is way too low. And there is one other area where the Bills are superior to that of New England, and it's the offensive line. You know, all five starters from last year are back. There'll be a guy pushing for a starting role at right tackle in Deion Dawkins with Jordan Mills. And you could argue that the offensive line could be even better this year. The problem is Brady gets rid of the ball so fast, you know, you could have five tackle dummies up there on the offensive line,
right,
and it still might not make a difference. So I think Brady compensates for maybe the lack of talent on their offensive line. 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550, the number to call. Is there a better roster in the NFL top to bottom than the New England Patriots? They certainly upgraded in some areas after winning the Super Bowl last year. Has a lot of people throwing their hands up saying, wow, they have a chance to be even better. I mean, I think there are some rosters out there, though, that could give them a run for their money. Now, there is one roster ranking on here that I think is completely out of whack and maybe projecting too far ahead. And we can talk about that in the next segment, because this is a team that was ranked in the top three. And, I mean, they weren't even in the playoffs last year. So I'm having a hard time coming to grips with this roster ranking that ESPN.com has. We'll talk about that roster along with any roster you think is superior to that of the Patriots on the other side of the break. It's Marlon Kerner and Chris Brown here on a Thursday edition of the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. From One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Marlon Kerner with you on a Thursday edition of the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts, and we're talking NFL rosters and who's got the best one top to bottom. Most people think New England. If you disagree, you can give us a call at 803-0550. You know, I mentioned before the break that there was one on this ESPN.com rankings list that I thought was completely out of whack, and I think they were making an awful lot of assumptions for a roster that does admittedly have some nice young talent, but there is no way that the Tennessee Titans should be ranked as having the third best roster in the NFL. I can't get there. I'm with you.
There's no way you can put them ahead of the Dallas Cowboys. You can't put them ahead of the Pittsburgh Steelers. You could go down a list and say, who would I go? I mean, there's no way. I would take 6, 7, 8, and maybe even the 9th team ranked on that list and say their roster isn't better than those guys. I mean, there's no way. I mean, they're young. Yes, Mariota is playing great. Delanie Walker is playing great at a high level. I mean, but you're unproven in your secondary. You've got a lot of young guys. Young offensive line. So
the offensive line is very – I mean, that's a nice group that they've got there that they've built. A lot of young players, as you mentioned. You know, Jack Conklin, the first-round pick at right tackle. Taylor Lewan, the first-round pick at left tackle. You know, so you got a couple of first-round picks there. They got the former Alabama center, Ben Jones, who they got out of Houston. And then, you know, you got Klein and Spain, serviceable guys at guard. So it's a good group, especially on the edges. And, you know, they helped at wide receiver with Corey Davis, just signed Eric Decker, though he's coming off hip and shoulder surgery. So you don't know there for sure. You got a great 1-2 punch in the backfield with DeMarco Murray and Derrick Henry. But their defense is long in the tooth. I mean, you got Derek Morgan. I think Jarrell Casey still has a lot of football left in him. He was in the 2011 draft. Super consistent player. Great anchor in the middle for them. But Logan Ryan, they get in free agency. Okay, good player. Denoris Searcy, Jonathan Cyprian, the safeties, veteran guys. LaShawn Sims, he's projected as a starter at right cornerback right now. I think Adoree Jackson, their first-round pick, takes over there eventually, if not sooner rather than later. But Brian Arakpo, I mean, there's another old guy. They have a couple of injuries. They're going to be playing a lot of unproven guys there really quick. And I understand a lot of people think Mariota's going to take off this year, and we've seen indications of that, especially the way he played down the stretch late last season. But it's not just the quarterback we're talking here. Now, looking at what they liked, you know, they say Jarrell Casey's a model of consistency. Their biggest weakness is a hole at the number two tight end because they don't have a true run blocker for their run game there. So, okay, I get that. That doesn't seem like a big deal. And then Mariota ranked 24th in the NFL last season at the quarterback position. They're claiming by surrounding him with the weapons they did this offseason that number is going to jump. Well, that's a guesstimate.
Right.
That's a guesstimate. Enough to make them number three?
There's no way. Again, and with him, he's a young guy, but he's – if you can knock him out, he's kind of frail. He doesn't look like he can take the pounding that's going to take. He didn't finish out the season last year. Had some injuries, mixed a few games. So again, if you can knock him around, if you can get that young offensive line to overextend and maybe not play as well as they're capable of doing, then can he take the pounding that, you know, he's not a guy that he's going to, if you sack him 50 times in a season, is he going to be there week in and week out? Again, by surrounding him with weapons, you're saying, okay, you can do that with every team. Hey, well, this team, they got this weapon, they got that weapon. They should be, by that logic, be now, their roster should be better, and they should be, you could rank them number three. You can't do that. Like, you're stretching. He was a 24th ranked quarterback. Like, no, he didn't put it like, I would take Jameis Winston and say, okay, by that same stretch, then you should say Tampa Bay should be up there because he's a young, up-and-coming quarterback, and is he going to make that jump? A bigger body, he can definitely take a little bit more pounding. He took all the snaps last season, turned the ball over a lot, maybe more than Mariota did. But, again, that logic says, okay, we're going to add a few more weapons, and now Winston's going to make the jump, and now he's going to jump up and become that top echelon of the quarterback. You can't make that argument. There's no way.
Yeah, I mean, I take the Carolina roster over them. I would take the Oakland roster over them. I take the Pittsburgh roster over them. I mean, there's a whole host of rosters that I certainly like better than Tennessee. Don't get me wrong. It's a nice young team, and they're putting the pieces together. You know, I think they're their GM, John Robinson, is a good GM and is going to build that thing the right way. I just don't think they're there yet. I mean, you rank them number three. That means you're saying this team has reached critical mass. They're going to go 11-5, 12-4, and run away with the AFC South. And I'm not convinced that that's going to happen yet. I like what Carolina did, not only in the draft, with McCaffrey, but, you know, they get Kelvin Benjamin back this year. And, you know, you have Devin Funchess, who I think has turned into a nice role player to complement Benjamin. And, you know, you still have the tight end there in Olsen. A lot is going to obviously hinge on how well Cam comes back from his rotator cuff surgery. But, you know, I still think they're good there, and I think they did a good job fortifying their defense in the last couple of drafts. So I would take the Carolina roster over them. So maybe even the Tampa Bay roster, like you were talking about. I might even take that Tampa roster over what Tennessee has right now. 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550 to talk NFL rosters with us. On the other side, though, we've got CBS Sports fantasy guru Jamie Eisenberg. He's going to help break it down for us a little bit more on the fantasy side of the roster business here across the league. That's coming up next here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
Radio Network Sports Update.
Your sports update from One Bills Drive. TSN's Pierre LeBrun is reporting that preliminary discussions are underway between the Buffalo Sabres and Jack Eichel. The team's centerpiece has a year left on his entry-level contract. The news is not much of a surprise, knowing that Edmonton's Connor McDavid is reportedly close to signing an 8-year deal worth $106 million. Bills running back Jonathan Williams was acquitted of DUI charges this past spring, but the NFL could have still enacted discipline against the second-year back based on the league's substance abuse policy. According to NFL.com's Ian Rappaport, Williams will not be disciplined by the league. Williams is the odds-on favorite to be LeSean McCoy's primary backup in 2017. Bills Hall of Famer Bruce Smith is apparently interested in providing some counsel to Cleveland Browns' number one overall pick, Myles Garrett. Smith believes Garrett will be a successful NFL pass rusher, but sees some minor flaws in his game. The league's all-time sack leader believes he can be of some assistance. Smith told the Akron Beacon Journal that minor adjustments can be the difference between a good and unforgettable NFL career. Former Ravens linebacker Zach Orr, who retired abruptly due to a neck condition a couple of years ago, is staging a comeback effort. Today he's meeting with the Detroit Lions. According to reports, up to 8 other teams have expressed interest. No word yet on the identity of those other clubs, but Orr will apparently visit with every team that's requested an interview. Passing a physical probably be the biggest hurdle for him. He's just 25 years old. Former Bills running back Carlos Williams facing a 1-year suspension from the NFL. That, according to ESPN.com, Williams, who had a game left to serve on a 10-game suspension following a second violation of the league's substance abuse policy, has apparently committed a third violation. The Bills released Williams after being more than 25 pounds overweight last summer and set to face a four-game suspension at that time. He was signed by Pittsburgh last year to their practice squad, but was released this past March. And the Bisons wrap up their series with the Red Wings today at Coca-Cola Field. First pitch at 1:05. That is your sports update here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. And joining us here in the second hour of the program, Chris Brown, Marlon Kerner with you. And joining us now on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline is CBSSports.com's fantasy football analyst Jamie Eisenberg to kind of go over some of this NFL roster talk we've been having. We've been kind of ranking the rosters top to bottom. Jamie's going to kind of dice it up for us more on the fantasy side of the ledger. Jamie, thanks for joining us. It's Chris and Marlon with you. We appreciate you giving us some time today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So you put a recent piece together on the Bills roster specifically, you know, as it applies to fantasy football. And, you know, I'm not surprised to see that you anticipate bigger and better things for Tyrod Taylor. But your projections are tied a little bit more to Sammy Watkins' health than maybe anything else. My question to you is, what about this scheme? Because we've heard Sean McDermott and we've heard offensive coordinator Rick Dennison both say they believe Taylor is a perfect fit for this offensive scheme. How much do you think that could potentially help him as well in terms of putting up numbers for his fantasy owners?
Oh, for sure. You know, he's a guy that I think as we get closer to the beginning to the middle of August will make a nice climb up my rankings, you know, especially if Watkins is on pace to be, you know, fine for training camp and shows he could play in some preseason games. Because, you know, Tyrod Taylor's put up very good numbers in spurts. He just hasn't been fantastic. He's better in leagues, not to get, you know, too fantasy nerdy on you, but he's better in leagues where there's only 4 points for passing touchdowns as opposed to six, because his rushing ability sort of offsets that. But I think if you get, you know, 13-plus games from Sammy Watkins with what he's capable of, with Zay Jones hopefully, you know, becoming a playmaker for them right away, and then whatever else they get from that receiving core, the offense would be great. You know, I got a chance to talk to Demaryius Thomas, who played for Rick Dennison in Denver at the Pro Bowl. Asked him about, you know, the offense in Buffalo, and he said, yeah, it's a great offensive plan, and certainly they set up the pass with the run, and that's a great situation for what you guys have with Buffalo.
You talked about Tyrod Taylor and where you thought he might end up in the season he might have, but weapons, Charles Clay. Where do you see him fitting in with this scheme, and what type of numbers do you think he might be able to put up this season?
You know, I don't know if Charles Clay will ever crack the starting group of fantasy tight ends, but there's certainly a chance if he can sort of put together, you know, 10, 12 games of consistent production. He's been good at times. You know, we usually talk about the guys you use during the waiver during the bye week period, you know, that you pick up off waivers, and that's kind of where I think Charles Clay will live for most of fantasy owners, unfortunately, until he starts to prove that he can, you know, post those consistent type of stats. But there's a chance. I mean, you know, again, it's an offense that while there is some hope, you know, for a guy like Zay Jones, while there is, you know, the expectation that Sammy Watkins plays, you know, the majority of the season, that's really it, you know, in terms of what the playmaker should be. Clearly there could be some good moments for an Andre Holmes here, a Corey Brown there, you know, maybe Rod Streeter can, you know, find the missing, you know, production that he sort of left on the field the last couple of seasons. But Charles Clay should be the third guy, you know, depending on where you put McCoy, but the third guy of the pass catcher, if everything kind of holds the way we expect it.
I might be a little more bullish on Clay than some other people, but there are a couple of reasons why. You know, Clay has spent the most time on the field with Tyrod Taylor on this entire roster, even more than LeSean McCoy. He's got 25 games with Taylor on the field, and because of Watkins' injuries, he doesn't have quite the time. And when you think about the turnover at the wide receiver position, I'm just thinking that Taylor's looking for guys he can trust out there. And I think he feels like he can trust Clay. And I know there was a problem in Taylor's game his first year as a starter in terms of finding targets in the middle of the field. But if you look at his last two starts with Clay in weeks 14 and 15 against Cleveland and Miami, I think Clay had something like 15 catches for 153 yards and 3 touchdowns in those two games. And I was anxious to see that take another step in the season finale. But as we all know, Tyrod had to take a back seat for the last game of the year when they decided to start Cardell Jones and that whole mess. But is there something to be said, Jamie, you think, for just on-the-field chemistry, knowing the turnover that's occurred at the wide receiver position for Clay that could benefit him early in the year?
Oh, for sure. You know, and believe me, we would love to see it. You know, I think you're talking about a position specifically that has had a lot of high expectations over the last few seasons. Clay was part of that, you know, after what he showed in Miami going to Buffalo on the big contract. And, you know, you're looking for guys to be consistent playmakers at that spot. So, yeah, for sure, the rapport factor is big. The fact that Taylor can trust him, the fact that the last two times they're on the field together, albeit in very favorable situations. I'm always a big fan of guys when they face their former team, like Clay did with Miami. You know, he's put up a couple big games against the Dolphins so far in his tenure there with the Bills. And the Browns last year were actually the worst team in terms of defending the tight end. So those are things to build off of, absolutely. And, you know, the one thing that you can talk about is if, in fact, it doesn't have to be, you know, like what we saw, you know, just to give you an example of the numbers that you saw from Clay in those last two games, or even like what Sammy Watkins did at the end of the 2015 season, doesn't have to be, you know, those astronomical numbers. If he can get you 7 to 8 points a week, he's going to be a starter for the majority of leagues. So hopefully Charles Clay can turn into that type of guy.
Now, we all know how good LeSean McCoy is, and we've got some question marks in losing Gillislee. What are your thoughts on Jonathan Williams? I mean, can he become that sleeper running back pick in leagues and that guy off our team that can come in and maybe take that second ring and put up some decent numbers?
I hope so. You know, I mean, that Gillislee role last year was fantastic. You know, you saw 9 total touchdowns, 5.7 yards per carry. You know, he was one of the best running backs, if not the best backup running back in the NFL. And the game that McCoy had to miss, you know, it was like there was no drop-off in terms of production. So, you know, Williams is not his final year at Arkansas because I think it was an ankle injury. But the year before that, you know, looked to be, you know, one of the premier running backs in college. And I think you still look at the Bills' offensive line to be one of the better ones in the league. It's going to be an offense that, as much as they're going to be more pass-happy, as I'm sure you guys are hoping to see, they'll still be, you know, relying on the run. And, you know, you can't give McCoy a 29 and the workload that he's had throughout his career every touch. And so if Williams comes in and can be that complementary option, I think you'll see certainly a lot of hope and excitement from fantasy owners. So he's somebody I think you got to look at if you're talking about late-round picks, whether you draft McCoy or not. You know, you use that term handcuff. You don't necessarily have to take those two guys together, but if you are looking for somebody that has some upside, if in fact McCoy goes down for a stretch like we saw 2 years ago, or as we saw last year, you know, Gillislee working in tandem with McCoy, Williams could be a potential starter for you if in fact that happens. He's what I like to call a lottery ticket. So if McCoy has to miss time for any reason, Williams steps in and could be a starter for your fantasy.
Jamie Eisenberg, CBS Sports Senior Fantasy Football Analyst, joining us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. You know, Jamie, with respect to McCoy, you know, we talked to him here in the spring, and we asked him some of the differences he anticipates under Rick Dennison, and he said the running backs get the ball a lot in the passing game. PPR leagues, I mean, talk to us about that, knowing, I mean, if you look at some of the history under Dennison and Kubiak, granted in Houston, but, I mean, Arian Foster a couple of years was the second leading receiver for the Texans with 50-plus catches. And that's certainly not foreign territory for McCoy, regardless of whatever scheme he's playing. And now he's talking about getting the ball even more. What about PPR leagues for a guy like McCoy? Does his value spike in this offense?
I think so, but it's hard for him to get much higher given how well he played last year. And he had 50 catches as well.
Right.
So. I think, you know, if he can somehow manage, and you're turning back the clock a lot when you're talking about not just McCoy, but the position he plays, because it's hard for running backs to turn back the clock, as you guys are well aware. But, you know, his second year in the league, 2010 with the Eagles, that was an offense that featured running backs catching the ball a ton. He had 78 catches that season. So if he can go from 50, you know, to let's just say 65 or higher, you know, he's going to challenge the top three guys. And for most fantasy owners, I don't think there's going to be anybody who cracks the top three on draft day, barring injury. When you talk about Le'Veon Bell, David Johnson, Ezekiel Elliott. But I have McCoy fourth. I think that's a great spot for him. He's a first-round pick, you know, no matter what format you play in. But certainly in PPR leagues, when you talk about where does he fall, because you're going to see some people maybe take him in the second round in a PPR league just because of all the receivers and how well they should perform. But I still think he's a first-round pick because if he's coming off of a season with 50 catches last year, I think he'd be in that 65-catch range. So really the only drawback for him is being 29, you know, and it's strange for a guy. I'm 40 to say somebody 29 is old, but it's the position that he plays. It's almost like dog years. You know, those guys age quickly, and hopefully McCoy gives us one more great season.
And then with respect to you know, losing goal line carries. I mean, McCoy was the victim of Gillislee last year because he would get some goal line carries. He'd lose out on some touchdowns. Now, Mike Tolbert's on this roster. He's known as a goal line type back. I don't know if Jonathan Williams is going to be employed in that role in any way, shape, or form. But how do you see, you know, McCoy potentially losing goal line carries again this year? Do you think there's a greater chance it happens or a lesser chance it happens with Gillislee out the door and new people coming in?
I think just given the skill set of the guy you mentioned, you know, there's probably a better chance that you see Tolbert, you know, probably taking him off the field in a couple of situations, maybe Patrick DeMarco as well. But he scored 13 touchdowns last year. So
yeah.
If he's not getting them, you know, right at the goal line, he's still going to find a way to score. So 14 total touchdowns. You probably figure, you know, you never want to ask somebody to replicate that. And really, he has two seasons of double-digit rushing touchdowns in his career. But I'm expecting 10-plus, you know, and again, if he loses a couple here or there, he'll pick it up in the yardage he should get from, you know, the more work he gets as a receiver. So McCoy is locked in as a top-five running back and certainly a first-round overall pick.
Now, for those deep teams, or deep leagues with a lot of teams, where do you see somebody like a Zay Jones? Like, what round should somebody be looking at, maybe picking him up in some of those PPR leagues?
Yeah, you know, he's going to be a late-round pick, I think, no matter what, outside of, you know, long-term dynasty type of leagues or keeper leagues where you keep guys for an extended period of time. He's got all the upside in the world. You know, I think you talk about this rookie wide receiver class. And, you know, the guys that were drafted earlier certainly be the ones that get the majority of the attention. When you talk about Mike Williams, John Ross, you know, that group of rookie wide receivers and just the chance they have. But it's when you get to that next group of guys, when you talk about Zay Jones and Kenny Golladay and Josh Reynolds and Cooper Kupp, you know, guys that have opportunities, Ardarius Stewart, you know, chances to be contributors as a rookie right away. Zay Jones is almost at the top of the list because it would not be a shock at all, and, you know, you guys could probably set me straight on this, but if he beats out Andre Holmes or he beats out Corey Brown, you know, guys that have been journeymen throughout their careers, why not throw Zay Jones in there right away if he understands how to block, you know, especially for a team that's looking to run the ball, if he understands the route tree enough, certainly can, you know, benefit from what should be a lot of single coverage because of the run game and because of Sammy Watkins if he's healthy. So I know you talked about the rapport that Tyrod Taylor should have with Charles Clay, which is great, but hopefully this is a guy that he develops a rapport with quickly because he could put up a lot of stats, and that's something we all love.
Yeah. Well, I know one thing's for sure. Zay Jones looks the part, or at least he did this spring, and looks to be quick on the uptake. The game doesn't look too big for him. It looks like he belongs. But listen, Jamie, we thank you for giving us time here on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, getting your insight here as no doubt fantasy football players out there are getting ready. They're already stacking their depth charts and stuff, so we appreciate you giving us some time today.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm actually going to Subway right now, so thanks for the putting it in my head.
Yeah. All right, so that's Jamie Eisenberg from CBS Sports, a fantasy football analyst, joining us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. You know, Zay Jones, for those deep leagues, 14 teams, 12 teams, you know, I think this is a guy where, you know, you can benefit if you can get him in those late rounds, because I think as the year goes on, even if he doesn't have a prominent role early, I can see him, you know, week 8, week 9, week 10, you start seeing him coming on and having a greater impact in the passing game. I think the reason that a lot of Bills players get marked down so much is not so much to do with Tyrod Taylor as a quarterback, but because over the last 2 years, this team has been near the bottom of the league in pass attempts per game. 2015, they averaged 27 pass attempts per game. It was second lowest in the league. Last year, they averaged, I think, 28.9, so about 29 pass attempts. I mean, Aaron Rodgers has 29 pass attempts halfway through the third quarter. So it's a little bit of a different animal here because they run the ball so well, and I get that. But I think it hurts Bills players when they get ranked on these fantasy lists that we see out there.
Definitely does. And you know, you talked about Zay Jones. I'm just having an opportunity to watch him. I mean, he definitely looks the part. He's got great size. He has an understanding. And I think the fact that his former coach, Phil McHagan, he understands what he can do. So I think you'll see a guy who can come in, and if he can pick up the terminology and understand that playbook, once he gets adjusted to the speed of the game, and I think, you know, we talk to all the rookies and we talk to them about the fact that, hey, this is a different type of league, the speed. Think of it as playing in an all-star game. Now you have all-star talent across the board at every position. So once he gets acclimated to the speed of the defenders and understands how to use that big body that he has, and he can make all the catches, he can make the tough catches, he can make using his body and shielding them. I mean, he's got strong hands, and he set the college record in receptions in a career. career. So, I mean, you look at what he's able to do. I mean, he's going to be a talent to watch. If he can come in, like you said, and it clicks week eight, week nine, that's another weapon that's going to be outside for Tyrod and help this offense.
See, and I was surprised that Jamie Eisenberg really didn't mention Charles Clay in his write-up on the Bills' fantasy options because, and granted, it's hard to live up to expectations when – you know, you're signed to an offer sheet the size that Clay was. I think the expectations were he was going to come in here and make catch 80 balls and 8 touchdowns a year. And this is, by and large, a run-first offense. I think that's hard to do, especially when you have a receiver the caliber of Sammy Watkins on the roster, too. Still in all, I really feel, and again, it was only a two-game sample, but I think Clay and Taylor took a step forward late last year in their on-field chemistry. And I thought Taylor took a step in his personal game in terms of finding targets in the middle of the field, most notably Clay. And granted, it was against the Cleveland defense, and it was against the Dolphins, who he's motivated to play against. But still in all, you got to make plays. And he had 15 catches for 150-something yards and 3 touchdowns in those two games. I mean, those are good numbers. And if you're in a PPR league, 15 catches in 2 weeks from your tight end – you're making some hay there.
Yes, you are. And I agree. Everything you said, he was one of those guys that I tried to pick up late, and he was snatched up by everybody in my league. And, again, once you start looking at what he was able to do and Tyrod and the chemistry, I expect big things between the two of those guys. I think the chemistry is there. I think the way this offense is, and we might have a little bit more inside knowledge of, you know, how some things look. But I think Charles Clay is somebody that you have to look at and say, you know what, if they can continue at the pace that they had last year, he found him in critical situations. I mean, it was, hey, we need a third down completion. I'm looking to find Charles Clay. I mean, and that was a huge turning point in Tyrod Taylor's game. Charles Clay, he made those tough catches. He used that big body to shield guys out. He held onto the ball. I mean, I look at the one he had where he broke the tackle of two guys coming on him. He full out. They came out full speed, hit him. He spun off and then went in for the touchdown. I mean, if he can continue to produce at that clip, you know, he can put up some really good numbers this coming season at that tight end position.
803-0550, the number to join us. If you want to talk a little bit about fantasy with the Bills roster, feel free to do that. We do have Paul in Rochester on the line who's got a question for us. Paul, what do you got for us?
Okay, how you doing, Chris? My two questions are, first, I don't think they, with Shady McCoy as the running back, the depth, because Shady does get banged up. I just think because they had Gillespie last year, and my other question is wide receiver. I know they're going with a few young players, but it was because Sammy's always injured. I still think they need another wide receiver, somebody to bring in this season.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we can assess that. I would say from the running back perspective, you could certainly make the argument that they're not as deep as they were last year. They went legitimately 3 deep last year, you know, with McCoy, Gillislee, and then rookie Jonathan Williams was the number 3. Here's the thing, though. I think Jonathan Williams can capably step into that backup role, and this is why. And he explained it, and I thought he laid it out really well. He didn't play at all his senior year. He broke his foot in training camp his senior year at Arkansas, had to have foot surgery. He didn't play his whole senior year, which also hurt his draft stock. So just think about this. He did not play at all in 2015. He gets drafted, and the first time he comes back to football is a year later, and he's got to do it at the NFL level. And I think the speed of the game shocked him because he hadn't even been playing on the field at college speed for a year. So I think it was a huge adjustment for him, more than it is for most college players. And I think by the end of the year, he got acclimated to the point where he could read the plays, find the holes, make decisions at the speed necessary to be productive and gain yards. Now I think he's poised to step into that role more effectively and be the number 2. The concern is number 3, which is a completely wide-open situation between Joe Banyard, Cedric O'Neill, and even the UB kid, Jordan Johnson. So who fills that role? I think it remains to be seen. And it wouldn't shock me if one of those guys who's practice squad eligible, Johnson chief among them at being an undrafted rookie, is put on the practice squad just for insurance purposes. So you have people who know the offense lying in wait in the event that disaster strikes and you need to pull somebody up. I kind of liked the downhill running style of both Banyard and O'Neill, but again, we're not in pads yet, and I don't think any of us can really make an accurate assessment of what either of those guys can effectively do until we see that. Where's their pad level? How are they after contact? And we're going to have to see one or two preseason games, I think, before any of us can make, you know, an educated assessment as to where the pecking order lies with those guys behind the top two. But depth-wise, yeah, you can't say it until we see these guys in preseason that the depth is okay at the running back position. And then his other question was
wide receiver.
It'd be great if you could get another one. They kicked the tires on Macklin, but it was clear they were not going to pay top dollar for him at this stage in the game, which to me indicates that they didn't see Macklin as a long-term participant on this roster. I think they're looking for guys that can help them not only this year, but the next year and the next year and maybe the next year after that. And so you've got some young, for lack of a better term, journeymen who've bounced around a little bit but are still on the right side of 28 years old. Andre Holmes, Philly Brown, Rod Streeter. And I think they're hoping that maybe they can catch lightning in the bottle with one of them, maybe two of them. And we're not talking about filling a major role. Maybe they're hoping Andre Holmes can be a two. But I think guys like Corey Brown or Rod Streeter, if they can capably fill in as a four, then I think they feel at least comfortable with where their depth is. It's certainly not ideal, but you can't fill every hole in one off season. You just can't do that.
No, and you're right. I mean, they're thin at the receiver spot, and you need young guys. I think at this stage, I mean, who are you going to go get? I mean, all the veteran receivers that had experience are on other teams. So, yes, when you get to training camp, if there's somebody that you like, you can look at it and say, you know what, we're going to add them to our roster and maybe bring them in late in the game. But then you still have to play catch-up and allow them to learn the offense, kind of play and get acclimated to what we're doing, the terminology. So, again, you're almost better served just saying, you know what, we've got some young guys. Let's work on developing them. Let's see if Andre Holmes can come in and get that number two or number three spot. Let's see where Philly Brown's going to be, if he can come in and step in. I look at the running back spot. Yeah, we've got some question marks there. But, you know, Tolbert, I mean, he can come in and fill and kind of come in and be that third down running back if you need that third running back, if you need him to be.
He can play
short yardage. He's an excellent blocking guy. He can be that goal line. So, you know, you've got other options. So don't just look and say, okay, we don't have a true – three deep running back situation. You got DeMarco who can come in and kind of be that play action running back on third down. So, I mean, there's options that you have with this roster that maybe they can get creative with and kind of think outside the box. So don't just look at it and say, well, you know, we don't know who our three running backs are going to be. You can kind of do a running back by committee and kind of take up and kind of get to where you need to be to kind of be as good as they were last season.
Yeah, I mean, I remember LeSean even saying, now don't discount Big Mike Tolbert as a ball carrier. He can still tote the mail, and that's according, you know, to a veteran in this league who obviously has respect for another veteran in this league. 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550, the number to call as we talk NFL rosters. We're going to talk about a different brand of football in our next segment as we talk to the founder of the American Flag Football League. He's got some big names playing in that league. Jeff Lewis is up next here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Marlon Kerner with you on a Thursday edition of the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. And we wanted to get into an interesting conversation about a new upstart league. You know, we've heard about all kinds of different football leagues, arena league. I think there was even a league in China, an arena league in China this past year that six teams just travel around to different cities. So we've seen different incarnations of the sport, and a lot of kids are familiar with flag football, but now they're trying to take it to another level. And joining us on the line now is the founder of the American Flag Football League, Jeff Lewis, joining us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Jeff, it's Chris and Marlon with you. Thanks for spending some time with us. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on, Chris.
So
nice to meet you guys.
Yeah, so maybe just first lay out for me the genesis of, you know, this idea and then bringing it to fruition, you know, in the form of the first game just earlier this week.
Sure. basically, this game comes from where most football comes from, which is the schoolyard and the backyard. You know, we've been trying to figure out what percentage of the time that people are playing football trying to score touchdowns that they actually have on helmets and pads. We think it might be 1%. You know, most football is really as simple as, you know, soccer. It's a ball in some open space, and you pick sides, and off you go. My son plays flag. He's just between 6th and 7th grade now. But it was probably in about 3rd grade that I noticed that their flag football games were becoming very entertaining just on their own. Not so much just because they're your kids and you care about your kids, but that just as the flow of the game and the action that was taking place, that they were interesting to watch, and much more so than other sports certainly played by kids that age. And so that's really where the idea kind of started and made me start thinking, well, what would this game look like if it was played by great players? And I have a number of friends who are really entrenched sort of in the football world, and I started talking to them about this, and they said, well, you have to see what's happening with 7-on-7. And as soon as I plugged into the whole 7-on-7 world, I realized that this is already happening, that even at the highest level, people are playing most of their football without hitting and without pads. You know, kids that are high school, aspiring high school players, you know, top-level college players, and even the pros, you know, they generally only hit once a week in practice. So really most of the football that's going on looks a lot like what we did out in San Jose, and I think it looks great. I think when people see what we put out there, they're going to really, really enjoy it.
Now, there's a lot of different rules of flag football. So, Jeff, how did you settle down on what type of rules you were going to employ for the league? And, you know, with the pass rushing, I mean, is there contact? Can you play bump and run? Are there certain downs you're allowed to blitz the passer?
Well, one of our key – we had a few things that we were trying to accomplish in the rules. We wanted the game to be simple. We wanted it to be safe. We wanted it to be speedy. And we wanted it to look like a football game. So there are a lot of traditional flag football rules that I think border a little bit on goofy looking. And we didn't want it to look like a flag football game. We wanted it to look like a football game. So some of the things that might be common in flag are not present. Some of it's really a little bit of a mixture of some of the flag rules that you've seen, some of the 7-on-7 rules that you've seen, and frankly, mostly it's really just traditional football. So formation requirements are very similar to traditional football. You know, the league is now very good about putting out some pretty detailed statistics. And so, like, for example, we have a lot of information about time to throw for quarterbacks. Average of 2.5, about a quarter of them under 2 seconds, about 20% over 3.5 seconds. You know, so you have all this data. And so we tried to build a construct that would lead to that result, so that what would end up happening is that our quarterbacks would go back, go through their progressions, and deliver the ball basically on time, basically in the same way that we're accustomed to watching it, you know, on Sundays. And I think we did very well with that. So we have 2 seconds to rush, 4 seconds to throw, but only if you're not rushed, and you can only run as a quarterback if you are rushed. We don't allow north-south handoffs, only east-west handoffs or pitches. And I think in the 2 games we played in San Jose, I'm trying to think, there were certainly less than 5 running plays in the, between 2 full games. There's no blocking, no tackling, because we're trying to create some uniformity also, something that's simple and safe that can be adopted by kids. And so we really wanted our game to be a game that with very few changes could be played by kids right away.
Talking to Jeff Lewis, the founder of the American Flag Football League, here on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. And, yeah, I mean, I think another rule that indicates that in terms of, you know, avoiding collisions and things like that, fumbles are dead balls at the spot of the drop, you know, according to some of the rules here. Touchdowns under 50 yards, 6 points. Anything over is 7. Teams can go for 2 or 3 after a touchdown. But the bigger question here, Jeff, is how were you able to loop in some household names right away, you know, with the likes of Michael Vick and Chad Johnson and T.O. Lining up and playing?
You know, it's funny. Michael was the first really big name that we were able to get involved. And as the conversation progressed, at one point, he kind of stopped and said for a second, you know, I just want to play. I can still throw the ball. I just want to get out there and play. And ultimately, I think that's really what drove a lot of the interest of a lot of the guys to be out there. You know, for most NFL players, the NFL decides when they're done, not the players. The average career is very short compared to other sports. And there's this remarkable number of really gifted athletes walking around who definitely still have something left to offer fans as far as entertainment. We think that what's so interesting about this game is we can draw from three pools of talent. We could draw from the former player, we could draw from the aspiring players, and then we could draw from athletes who may not necessarily have ever really had any kind of feeling that they could play in the NFL because they just might not be built for it. But that doesn't mean they're not athletic, and it doesn't mean they might not have the speed to be very effective in flag football. It is interesting that we did see something out in these games that wasn't really what I expected, which was that there were a couple of guys who were probably the two biggest, slowest guys on the field who were very effective. Nikita Whitlock, former Giant on one team, and Evan Rodriguez, who you mentioned, on the other team. And these guys were running good routes in the middle of the field, and the faster guys were kind of spacing out the defense, and these guys were very, very effective. So we're going to learn a little bit in terms of, you know, what is the ideal flag football player. You know, we even had a professional lacrosse player, Max Seabold, who played in the two games, who won the equivalent of the Heisman Trophy a few years ago for lacrosse, and he was very, very effective as a defensive player in this game, sort of illustrating that idea that we're going to find lots of different types of athletes who excel in this. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of these players really enjoy the game. They're still looking for an opportunity to have teammates and to have some competition. And I think it really is about, a lot of it is about that. I think when I've talked to a lot of the ex-players, I think they miss the teammates and they miss the competition as much as anything when it ends for them.
So this looks like, you know, these two games look like kind of more of a showcase type thing. What do you envision long range? Do you envision specific teams, or do you think this is going to be more of a traveling? I don't have a better term, so I'm just going to say kind of like a traveling showcase, where you're going maybe city to city to get the exposure, and then if it really takes off, then do you think about assembling specific teams for different cities?
Chris, we actually, for 2018, are going to run the first ever U.S. Open of football.
Okay.
So we're going to put together a giant 1,024-team bracket of any team that wants to join the tournament and play for the prize.
Okay.
And we're kind of really looking at American Idol, American Ninja Warrior, a lot of these kinds of events that at the end of the day have ended up bringing out amazing talent, amazing quality. And obviously not all 12,000 players that enter something like that are going to be good enough that you'd want to watch them on TV. But we're not going to start showing the games on TV until we're down to 64 teams.
Okay.
So by the time we get to where we're presenting the games to the public, I think you're going to be looking at something that's on a really high level and really interesting in terms of where did these people come from, how did they get to be so good, how much have they been playing together. I think the tournament is going to be amazing. And then once all those 1,000 teams have broken down to eight, then our eight, what I would call super teams, will enter the picture. They will automatically qualify for the round of 16. And our eight teams will look a lot like the kind of players that you saw out there this week. And they'll be waiting for whoever can get through this massive event. So you really have, I think, for the teams that enter, you have two prizes. One is just to have the opportunity to play against some of your heroes and see how you stack up. And then, obviously, the second is the opportunity to win the tournament and win the prize.
And so where can
that's the plan for next year.
Right. And so is there a place people can go for more information, not only maybe on that upcoming tournament next year, but also just if they're interested in catching, you know, a game when one is up next on the schedule?
Yes, absolutely. So our website is AmericanFlag.football. And it's funny, every time I say that to people, they say .com. I say, no, just .football. And they're like, anybody can have .football. Well, you can. AmericanFlag.football. There's a place there to put in your information if you'd like to be informed when we start taking entries for the tournament. We'll also have information there as to where you can see the game, which will be very, very soon. It's only going to be a very short time before the game that we played does become available for people to watch the stream. And I really want people to take note of it. When they watch the stream of the game, we really tried to change the whole orientation of how you watch this game. And we really spent a lot of time looking up and down the field as opposed to across the field. It was a couple of years ago I noticed my son was sitting playing Madden, and I noticed that the perspective of Madden was, or at least the way he was playing it, was up and down the field, and he was designing his formations and calling his plays. And I thought it actually looked so much more interesting than watching a game from the side. So when we sat down with our TV people and we created this, we had 18 cameras. This was quite a production. So I really think people are really going to enjoy not only the game, which is a lot of fun, and you see how much fun the players are having when they're freed up of all the equipment, but also it'll be really fun, I think, for people to see, you know, the orientation and the technology and the way that we presented it, which I hope they find, you know, pretty cool and pretty innovative.
Well, Jeff, we thank you for your time, just in kind of shedding some light on this. I mean, we're only privy to, you know, a couple of minutes on YouTube. You really kind of gave us the full scope. So thanks for joining us, and good luck with the league.
Thank you very much, guys. Have a great afternoon. Have a great 4th of July.
Yes, you too. That's Jeff Lewis, the founder of the American Flag Football League, joining us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. And I got to say, you know, off the bat, I was like, what kind of traction is this going to get? But it seems like this is a guy that has put an awful lot of thought into doing this the right way. And I will say this, you know, for a YouTube kind of stream of a game like this, having 18 cameras on the field, I think that shows the kind of commitment this guy has to do this thing the right way. There were graphics on the field for time the quarterback has to throw. I mean, this isn't some, you know, mom and pop operation here. They're really trying to do this first class. It's just going to be interesting to see where this goes. I find that the tournament concept pretty interesting, because when you think about it, that really hasn't been applied to football to a degree of that magnitude, 64 teams, you know, in a tournament for football. And you can do that. And the reason you couldn't do that previously is because, you know, you've got guys beating on each other in pants. 7-on-7 is a completely different thing.
It's going to be interesting to watch. I agree with you, what you said. Him and the amount of cameras that he put in there, the rules they adopted is kind of interesting. I mean, they won it quick. They won a lot of touchdowns.
A lot of high scoring.
Vic threw, what, 8 touchdown passes in the game. So, I mean, it's going to be very fun to see how this takes off. I mean, there's a lot of 7-on-7 tournaments throughout the country, so I can see a lot of teams jumping in and trying to see how they stack up against a Michael Vick, how they stack up against a T.O. or a Chad Johnson, who is still running on treadmills at 22 miles an hour. So, I mean, it's going to be fun. You're going to get a lot of different guys. I know guys that play flag football here that probably are already getting their teams together, trying to figure out, all right,
flag,
when is this
training camp?
See?
Is that what we're
flag
talking about?
Flag training camp, getting ready to go.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us here for this segment. But coming up in the next segment, I got to ask Marlon Kerner about a former teammate of his who's apparently willing to play counselor. We'll talk about that after the break here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Marlon Kerner with you here on the John Murphy Show as we are close to closing out hour number 2 of the program. And I wanted to talk to Marlon in this segment about one of his former teammates. Bruce Smith has some advice for another number 1 pick, this year's number 1 pick, Myles Garrett. The Cleveland Browns' newest pass rusher out of Texas A&M. And according to Bruce, there is a fine line between a good career and an unforgettable one. And right now, he has a little bit of a concern about a couple of minor flaws in Myles Garrett's game. Obviously, he's watched some of his college games or college tape, who knows. And Bruce doesn't say, he thinks that Garrett is going to be a successful player in this league. I mean, he is freakishly talented. But where Bruce is coming down is he thinks that at times Garrett was a little slow off the ball. And he talked to the Akron Beacon Journal, and he basically said to them, "I'm here to offer counsel if Myles Garrett wants it." First, what do you think of Bruce's offer? And then second, how would you react if you were Myles Garrett?
You know, I think for the offer, you would definitely like what he's saying. I mean, if I'm Myles Garrett, I'll go Myles Garrett side first. If I'm Myles Garrett and I'm looking at arguably the greatest defensive end to ever play this game, if he's saying, "Hey, I see some things technique-wise that could make you better, and I want to share those secrets with you," you have to say, okay, what do you have to share? This is not somebody who was never drafted. This is not somebody who's not a Hall of Famer. This is arguably...
This isn't LeVar Ball? Is that what
this you're... isn't LeVar Ball and Big Baller Brand saying, "My son is only going to play for the Lakers." I mean, this is Bruce Smith, the all-time sack leader in the NFL, somebody who's done it for 20 seasons and was a number one overall pick, so understands the pressure that you're going to face, understands how defenses are going to try to attack you because you are athletic. He might not have been as athletic as Garrett is now, I mean, but coming out, when he came out, he was considered freakishly athletic for a big man, could move, the things that he could do, that first step off the ball. So if he's saying, "Hey, I see some things that can make you better," and one being your first step off the ball, if you can learn how to get that and improve that, it's only going to make you better. You have to listen to it. I think it's a good offer from Bruce. I think it's something where you're not going to say, "Okay, Bruce, come down, fly down, show me this, show me that." I think it's more of a, "Hey, here's my game film. Let's talk on a weekly basis. Here's what I did to improve it." And you may go out there and spend some time with Bruce for a weekend or some time. He might be out there now with him, training with him and figuring out what he did and what it took to make him better. And then you kind of get back and just kind of go on a mentor basis. Like, "Hey, we're going to talk after a couple games. We're going to talk every Monday after a game, and you're going to critique me and tell me what I did. Or I'll send you my game film. You take a look at it. We'll follow up on a Friday and give me those pointers, and then we'll touch base maybe during a bye week."
Yeah, Bruce's angle here is if you get off the ball simultaneously to the ball being snapped, sometimes you're going to beat the offensive lineman out of his stance. Then on other occasions, it's going to be the difference of whether you just get a sack or a forced fumble or just a hit on the quarterback or just a hurry. The funniest part of this whole story is what Greg Williams, the defensive coordinator in Cleveland, told Myles Garrett when he first showed up at the Cleveland facility. He said, quote, "You are here to work and help your teammates, and you will talk with your play. Secondly, you will show respect to our owners and to this franchise and to its history and the city of Cleveland. When you come back here for rookie minicamp, you will get to work. I look forward to being your father now and for the rest of your life." Which is a typical Greg Williams quote.
Yes, that is.
Coming up in the final hour of the John Murphy Show, Marlon and I are going to talk a little bit about the offensive line for the Buffalo Bills. Obviously, they've been extraordinarily successful in running the football. Pro Football Focus had an interesting look at their level of success with different run concepts, and not surprisingly, they ranked pretty high. We'll tell you how high on the other side and see what the future is for that running game under new coordinator Rick Dennison in his new offensive scheme. That's next on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive. This is Buffalo Bills Radio.
Radio Network Sports Update.
Here's Sports Update from One Bills Drive. TSN's Pierre LeBrun is reporting that preliminary discussions are underway between the Buffalo Sabres and Jack Eichel. The team's centerpiece has a year left on his entry-level contract, so they are talking new contract now. The news is not much of a surprise, knowing that Edmonton's Connor McDavid is reportedly close to signing an 8-year deal worth $106 million. Bills running back Jonathan Williams was acquitted of DUI charges this past spring. But the NFL could have still enacted discipline against the second-year back based on the league's substance abuse policy. According to NFL.com's Ian Rappaport, Williams will not be disciplined by the league. Williams is the odds-on favorite to be LeSean McCoy's primary backup in 2017. Bills Hall of Famer Bruce Smith is apparently interested in providing some counsel to Cleveland Browns' number one overall pick, Myles Garrett. Smith believes Garrett will be a successful NFL pass rusher, but sees some minor flaws in his game. The league's all-time sack leader believes he can be of some assistance. Smith told the Akron Beacon Journal that minor adjustments can be the difference between a good and unforgettable NFL career. Former Bills running back Carlos Williams facing a one-year suspension from the NFL. That, according to ESPN.com, Williams, who had a game left to serve on a 10-game suspension following a second violation of the league's substance abuse policy, has apparently committed a third violation. And the Bisons are wrapping up their series with the Red Wings today at Coca-Cola Field. No score right now in the bottom of the third. That is your sports update here from One Bills Drive. Chris Brown along with Marlon Kerner on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. And there was a discussion that Marlon and I wanted to take on here in the third hour of the program, and it deals with Buffalo's offensive line. Pro Football Focus put together an interesting piece on the best offensive line units based on run concepts in 2016. Now, we obviously know that the Bills were, again, for the second straight season, number one in the league in rushing, number one in yards per carry average, and they were at the top of the league in a lot of categories regarding run game efficiency. So I guess it comes as no surprise that we would see them ranked high in a category for run play concepts. I think what took me aback when I looked at these rankings was basically what they did was they broke it down to three basic run concepts: the outside zone concepts in terms of the running game, inside zone, and then they also had the gap scheme, you know, in terms of assessing the effectiveness of each of the teams across the league. So the Bills, not surprisingly, with an outside zone concept, finished first in the league. They averaged 5.73 yards per carry and 2.77 yards for the running back before contact. And people might say, well, you know, you got Shady McCoy, he makes people miss. Well, when you're running outside zone plays, you're working through an alley there. There's not a lot of wiggle room. So if you're blocking it right, your back's getting through before he's getting hit. And I thought the most impressive thing was teams on average, as you see at the bottom of the screen, the MSG viewers, 3.84 yards per carry. The Bills are almost 2 yards better than that. I mean, that's a downright impressive number.
That's a great number. When you start looking at it and the number of times that we run the ball inside, and then the fact that you can go ahead and bounce it outside. And I think a lot of it also has to do with Tyrod ability to escape from pressure. So, you know, when you start looking at your quarterback being able to pull outside and get past that first wave of rushers, it opens it up. It makes teams begin to play honest. And so then once you start giving the ball to Shady and Aguilesley and they decide to bounce it and get out there, I mean, those guys are lows. I mean, Shady gets to the side, he gets there quickly. And so, you know, when you look at 2.77 yards before contact, I mean, you're almost getting to where the cornerback is going to be or that safety's coming down in the box to be there before you start seeing that first sign of contact. I mean, that's going to be a very successful run game and run scheme for the entire season. And as you can see, we led a lot of categories and statistics in that run game. And, you know, that's credit to our offensive line. I mean, that means those guys are sustaining that first wave of blocks, and then they're getting to the second level and getting to linebackers and then coming off of those linebackers and even getting to corners. Our receivers doing a great job out there. So that's a total team effort to lead in that statistic.
Right. And, you know, as you astutely mentioned, outside zone was run less by the Bills than inside zone. As a matter of fact, by more than a 3-1 margin, because when it comes to the inside zone, Bills, again, number one in the league. But they ran it 97 times inside zone as opposed to outside zone just 30 times. But the results were largely the same. 5.38 yards per carry, 2.71 yards gained by the back before contact. Again, first in the league, better than Dallas at doing this. And they have just as many attempts. So the sample size is comparable, and yet they are still better by 0.2 yards and better in the yards before contact area as well. And again, when it comes to the league average, yards per carry for the Bills, more than a yard better per play. And so you look at that, and this is the most successful run concept in football right now. Most teams run this. They have some measure of success, granted not maybe as successful as the Bills or the Cowboys, who were at the top of the league in this category. But to see the ability to run inside and outside, I think speaks to the versatility of this group that the Bills have up front in terms of executing different plays. And I think it bodes well, more importantly, for the system that's coming in the door under Rick Dennison, does it not?
Yes, it does. When you start talking about what your offensive line can do, and more importantly, you have a running back, because most people think, okay, Shady's not that big of a back, so he's not going to run inside. Well, he runs the ball inside, and he's very shifty. He makes a lot of guys miss. He makes linebackers miss. He'll make a safety miss. I mean, he is cut on a dime for a reason. I mean, he is so shifty, and he does it at such a full speed that you're kind of like, oh, my gosh, that's amazing. But most guys think, like, okay, he doesn't run inside enough because you can't get a good shot on him. Like, he's quick to get down. He knows when to take the shot, when he shouldn't take a shot. I haven't seen anybody be able to really take a clean, full shot on him at any game at all last season. So that's credit to him. But the offensive line, again, I mean, when you look at that zone scheme, and what they do and their ability to sustain blocks. I mean, that's at the point of attack, sustain blocks. And if you're not getting hit until almost 3 yards, that means your offensive line is controlling the line of scrimmage. And, again, with the new scheme that we have coming in and the way they like to attack and the way they like to get those matchups with that zone blocking scheme, I'm excited to see what it's going to bring, because if you give a back like Shady an opportunity to cut left or right, and teams aren't disciplined, that is the difference between him making a play maybe average and get maybe that 5.7 we averaged last year to 5.2 or 5.38 to him taking it to the house. And we saw what he did against Jacksonville when he came back and he cut it right there, and he just popped and he went 75 yards just like that. It's going to bode well for him to be able to break a lot of long runs this upcoming season.
You could tell. You know, we interviewed him a couple of times through the course of the spring, and naturally we asked him about, you know, the new scheme and his thoughts on it, and he thinks it's somewhat similar to some of the things he did early in his career. You know, there are West Coast principles to some of what Coach Dennison employs in terms of his playbook. You know, so knowing he played under Andy Reid and some of those West Coast principles also, I think there are some parallels that he felt he was able to draw to his earlier days of playing, and that's when he had some of his most successful seasons.
Yeah, I mean, again, when we talk about being a defensive back, you don't want a running back to have a two-way go. You never want to give anybody an opportunity to go left or right. And so when you start talking about this blocking scheme, what it does is it makes a defense have to be committed to staying in their gap and staying in their responsibilities. And the moment that somebody gets outflanked or doesn't do what they're supposed to do, it creates huge cutback lanes, or even if they just become undisciplined at the point of attack, you get body on body, and all of a sudden your running back is now out onto the second level, and now you have McCoy who's one-on-one with a corner or a safety, and I'll take that matchup anytime at any point in any game. So again, when you start looking at what they want to do and the concepts they want to build upon it, it's always sealing the backside, always making sure that you don't have an opportunity to let the backside chase down from behind. And if you can do that, and then those guys become undisciplined and they want to try to jump in or do something and you've got a body there, LeSean McCoy has got to be licking his chops saying, you know, I've got a lot of opportunity to start one way, be patient, and then cut it back and make 10, 15, 25-yard, 30-yard runs consistently throughout the season.
And then we've got the last run concept that Pro Football Focus examined was the gap scheme. And, you know, multiple run concepts within a gap scheme, unlike outside zone and inside zone. So it's the most featured run concept in the league. It was attempted almost 4,000 times. But again, the Bills rank very high, number 2 in the league in terms of average yards per carry. And they certainly did not have a small sample size. They had 119 attempts, which was higher than the league average of 106. And again, more than a yard better on average in terms of yards per carry, 4.08 for the league average, 5.23 for the Bills. They finished second in the league, only to Atlanta, and their yards before contact number is high again, 2.48. bested only by Atlanta at 2.83. And, oh, by the way, the Bills have Atlanta's fullback now. So, you know, you think about that, and, you know, I don't know how deep you need to get into the X's and O's, Marlon, but maybe explain how maybe the gap scheme differs from inside zone, outside zone per se in terms of, you know, how the backs are employed, how the line is deployed.
You know, when you run your gap scheme, I mean, you can kind of come off and do a lot more combo things that you want to do. You know, you can do fullback one way and have your fullback become that lead blocker and kind of take on. So you can kind of let people come upfield, do some kickouts, do some things that maybe you wouldn't want to do on an outside zone scheme, because you want to sometimes take advantage of the fact that you want somebody to come upfield. You want that pressure. You want them to think they're going to be there to make a play. And then you want to be able to get that fullback, tight end, your guard or your tackle to kind of kick out, seal them out, and then allow your running back to cut up inside that. And so, you know, the scheme and principle that they want to use is you have so many choices. You have so many combinations that you can do. And so it makes it very hard to defend. And when you have, like Atlanta, they only ran 77 attempts. But
right.
When you have two running backs that can hit the hole like they do, and so when you think you have a running back dead to rights, you think you've read the play and diagnosed it the way it should be, and all of a sudden, boom, you've got somebody who you didn't expect to come and block you and seal you off or get kick you out of that, you know, it kind of makes it difficult, because if you're the frontside linebacker and that's your key and you read it, you thought you read it perfectly, and all of a sudden, bam, fullback comes, tight end comes, tackle comes from somewhere else, and you didn't expect it. Now, all of a sudden, who's there to pick up that responsibility? It creates huge holes. And if your running back is fast enough and shifty enough and quick enough to get there and make all you need to do is make one guy miss. And once you get there, you're at second level. And if you can kick a linebacker out with that gap principle, oh my gosh, and when you start talking about the running backs that we have and what LeSean McCoy can do, now you're starting to talk about, oh my gosh, and we have offensive linemen that are mean, that are nasty, that can get out there. They love the block. That's what they do. You know, your center can come off with Eric Wood. So we've got a lot of guys up front that are really more than up to the task of being able to do that and block that well.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Eric Wood, because when you're running that outside zone run concept, you really have to have a center that can execute that reach block, you know, and get the leverage, you know, as soon as they get out of the stance and snap
right.
the ball, and Eric is very good at that.
Very good at that.
That's really a key to making that play go, because if he can't execute that block, and a reach block is hard. You're reaching across your gap, you know, to execute a blocking assignment and then get going. If your center can't do that, you can't run outside zone.
No, you can't. And that's why you look at how versatile our offensive line was. You know, your guard's got to be able to get out there too, and you've got to be able to do it. And your tackle has got to be strong at that point of attack. And so you've got to look at what we were able to do, and having all five guys come back, it just bodes well. I mean, if you're that great in the categories now, and then now all of a sudden the guys that were – as good as they were last year, they're all back. You add Dawkins to the mix. You still have Groy, who can fill
Dukas.
In and play all positions. You added Dukas. You've got
– He's like your swing guard.
You can do a lot of different things. You have depth that we didn't have last year. So if an injury does happen, you won't see the drop-off that normally happens when you bring in a backup.
And I think, too, you know, you think about – I'm encouraged to see a team like Atlanta – high in some of these categories too. They were third in outside zone, and then as we saw in the gap scheme, they were first in the league. And part of the reason that Pat DeMarco was an appealing acquisition for the Bills is because some of what he ran down there under Shanahan has some similarities. I mean, Rick Dennison got a lot of what he runs from Shanahan's dad, Mike Shanahan.
Right.
And so Kyle Shanahan ran a lot of those same things in Atlanta. And I talked to Pat DeMarco about that, and he's like, yeah, there is a lot of carry over here. And so I think the transition for him will be seamless in terms of some of those responsibilities. But it wouldn't surprise me if they weave a little of that gap stuff in, knowing how successful Atlanta was with it. And I think DeMarco is one of those guys that can seal people off and lure them in on the edge, don't you?
I agree. And I think that's why when you start talking about, I know the caller brought it up earlier about depth at the running back position, you got guys that can come in and maybe aren't traditionally labeled, oh, you're a running back, but they can come in and do some of the same things that you're looking for your tailback to do. And so when you have two fullbacks that can come in, it can be blockers, they can also run the football, they can catch the ball, you know, you don't have to necessarily worry about depth at that position, because – you know, DeMarco can come in and do – he's versatile. I mean, he can block. He's going to be very shifty. Guys don't see him. The AFC guys didn't see him a lot. So, you know, he's going to be coming, and it's going to take them a little bit to adjust to his game and his style of play. And then you add what we want to do in the run concepts, and he's going to be able to kind of – and then all of a sudden now you've got play action. So now we're talking about running the ball,
right.
And then all of a sudden you think he's going to block you, comes out, oh, I saw this play before,
yeah.
And all of a sudden he goes right by you and he has more than capable hands.
Swing
pass. Swing pass. You can get him out to the flats. You can get him on an angle route. You can get him on a wheel route. So, you know, it's going to be very exciting to watch this offense if they can get those concepts down and that offense can perform at the same level they performed at or even better for this upcoming season.
So I guess it's safe to say we should see the numbers for, 30 attempts outside zone, according to Pro Football Focus for the Bills last year, 97 attempts for inside zone last year. Should we expect to see both of those numbers go up under Rick Dennison?
I think you definitely see those numbers go up under Rick Dennison. I think the approach and the concept and the style of what they want to do, you'll see definitely some more outside zone runs coming up out there. And then, again, it's can teams decide to stay disciplined? Because when you have a mobile quarterback, you have to decide, am I going to blitz him and make him make a bad decision? But Tyrod has proven that he can escape and get out. And so once LeSean McCoy has success, then you also now add that bootleg, and you can kind of have that quarterback start now, fake the run, roll out, and now he has a dual threat. He can decide to run it, or he can hit your fullback out in the flat. So you may see Shady have great success, and all of a sudden it opens it up for Tyrod. And then once Tyrod has success, then your fullbacks are going to start coming to play because now you got to have a spy. And so Charles Clay becomes an option because now he's going to come across where the linebacker vacated.
Or those linebackers are cheating.
Right. So, all this runs, it starts up front. If those guys can kind of do what they did last year and piggyback on that and become more successful than what they were last year, it bodes well for our offense and the numbers that they can put up.
And the scary thing is we're talking about all this, and naturally we're talking run game concepts, but if they can do all of that, be as productive as they were last year, we haven't even mentioned Sammy Watkins or any of the receiving options outside of Clay and outside of DeMarco, you know, as a move guy and maybe a guy that'll swing out and catch a swing pass or a screen pass or something like that. You know, it's hard not to get excited about it because you got to believe that if this run game is as effective as we believe it will be under Coach Dennison, that it's going to force defenses to put their attention on that, and then that should cater to more opportunities outside for guys like Sammy and, you know, whoever the number two receiver winds up being, because you got to believe these opponents are going to have to play single safety high a lot just to slow down what they're doing in the run game.
You're right. I mean, if LeSean McCoy comes off and he starts, and this starts week one, and he comes out and he just starts lighting it up, teams are going to have to say, I got to bring the safety down. So I've got to get out and take this run away, which means now you've got Sammy and Andre Holmes and Zay Jones and whatever of those receiving crew that are out there one-on-one. And you got to like that matchup. Somebody has got to be able to get open and beat their man one-on-one. And then once that happens, now you got to say, okay, am I going to take away this passing attack that's been hurting us? And if you do that, now the run game comes back in play. So, again, it's can you really get them off kilter on defense? And if our offensive line can do what they did last year, you know, we didn't even talk about what they did pass blocking wise. You know, those guys were pretty good at times. Sometimes teams were able to get pressure on us by design. But
right.
Definitely as the season went on, I thought pass blocking wise, the offensive line definitely improved and got better late in the season. And Tyrod was able to find guys open and find his weapons and hit them in stride. And I think that was the main thing, you know, in rhythm. And
so,
get them out there.
So do you anticipate, because we saw this on occasion last year where teams would spy Tyrod with a linebacker or a safety or what have you. Oakland did that, I remember, in the game out there. Is it higher risk to spy Tyrod going against this run scheme under Dennison? Is the risk higher to devote a player to Tyrod, you know, when they can throw this kind of a run game scheme at you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, because you're taking someone out of the point of attack because he has to hold back and see where Tyrod is. So he has to play him. So, again, if you take and say, I'm going to devote this linebacker to spying on Tyrod Taylor, then if you do that and it's not a run for Tyrod Taylor,
right,
and you hand the ball off to LeSean McCoy, who's there? That running back is going to be late. He's not going to be at the point of attack. And if he's fast and he gets there and he says, okay, I think it's going to be a run, and he's wrong, and he flows too quickly and Tyrod pulls it out, Tyrod now has the corner and he has the edge. So normally spies are going to be very, very slow playing because they don't want to commit to the run until they see it. And once you commit and he hands the ball off, it's too late because now you're in chase mode.
Right. And I think those are some of the concepts that Coach Dennison talked about back in May when he spoke to the media, because – you know, we said to him, look, the last 2 years, these guys have been pretty doggone good. You know, I don't think you want to throw it all on the scrap heap and throw what they've done the last 2 years into the dumpster. And he said, oh, no, absolutely not. And he said, as a matter of fact, I, along with offensive line coach Juan Castillo, have talked about some of the concepts we've seen these guys execute consistently and get production the last 2 years. And we've talked about finding ways to incorporate that into our own playbook. They don't want to get rid of it if they can do it well. As Coach Dennison said, it's not about me. It's not about Coach Castillo. It's not about LeSean McCoy or any one player. It's about what's going to be best for this offense to help us win football games. And so, for me, just seeing so many coaches come through the door over the years and say, you know, this is the way we're going to do things, to hear that from a veteran coach like Rick Dennison, who has a mind that's clearly open enough to say, you know what, this works pretty well. We should find a way to incorporate this into what we do. Just knowing they've got that open mind to take from what has been successful for this rushing offense the last 2 years and be willing to blend it into what they have, I just think could speak volumes for, because it's just another page you can add that you can turn to that you, who knows, you might need that in week 15 or something and turn to that and give them a different look that, you know, that you haven't utilized in the last four games, which is what most teams advance scout, your last four games.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like you said, and I think it speaks more to the fact that that's why he's been successful. Good coaches understand that, you know, they don't always have all the answers. And more importantly, if a team does something well, why am I going to come in and try to reinvent the wheel? If these guys are great doing this blocking scheme and blocking this way and blocking this style, then maybe I should look at, okay, they do this well. Here's some concepts that I know that they'll be really good at. But let's take some of the concepts that we know they already know how to execute, and they executed at a high level, incorporate that into our playbook. And now teams are like, okay, now what are they going to do? Because, you know, yes, teams have seen that zone blocking scheme. They've seen what Denver's done. They've seen what Houston has done at some of the other stops that he's been at. So they already have film on some of the styles that they want to block. They know they want to block. So yeah. Now you can say, I know they're going to do this. Here's how we're going to attack it. But if you can keep them off balance by saying, hey, you know what? We're going to keep some of the style that you used last year that kept a lot of teams off balance, that helped, made you be successful. We're going to take that, keep that, add what we want to do to it. Now we're going to be that much better. I'm excited to see exactly how that all is going to shake out.
I really want to see it unfold. That's probably one of the things I'm looking forward to the most with respect to the 2017 campaign. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, it's time for real news and fake news. I'm going to put Marlon to the test here and have him make a call on some interesting issues around the league, and some with some Bills ties as well. We'll get to that on the other side. This is the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts. From One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show.
Chris Brown, Marlon Kerner with you as we are closing in on the second half of the final hour. You like my fractions there? The John Murphy Show. I'm just trying to make people think I wasn't really good at fractions ever, but that's neither here nor there. We're discussing a number of things today on the program, all NFL, obviously, and now it is time for my most exciting part of the show, at least as it pertains to one Marlon Kerner. It is time for real news, fake news, brought to you by Yancey's Fancy, New York's artisan cheese. So we're going to pitch you a few things, and we're going to see where you come down, whether you think it's fake news or real news.
Okay.
The first one comes from an NFL.com ranking that came out this week. They suggested that Stephon Gilmore and Malcolm Butler are now the NFL's best cornerback duo. Real news or fake news?
I think I read that article, and I think they were talking about Aqib Talib and his secondary.
Chris,
so I'm going to say fake news off of that
one. So you're still giving Denver the nod.
I'm giving Denver
Chris
the
Harris
nod. Chris Harris and Talib. I mean, those two guys are yeah, they're the real deal.
You know, we talked earlier when we were talking about NFL rosters, and, you know, Jacksonville came up. You know, they signed Bowie in free agency from Houston, and they have Jalen Ramsey on the other side. Granted, they've got the proof will be in the pudding.
Right.
But that could be a cornerback tandem that could move up the board considerably this year. That's a pretty talented duo.
Very talented duo, as is Stephon Gilmore and Butler, but they haven't played together yet. So I'm going to go fake news just because we got to get a season out of
You're playing wait and see.
Wait and see.
Okay, we've discussed this on the show already. The Atlanta Falcons have the best roster, top to bottom, in the NFL. Real news or fake news? Do you have a roster that's better?
No, and I think that is real news. That is the story in the article that came out. But I like what New England did. If you're just purely looking at it from an X's and O's type of standpoint, never been a fan of New England. But definitely the Falcons, top to bottom, they're built for success, and we're going to have our hands full when we go down there and play them.
Right. I mean, Julio Jones, probably the most dominant receiver in the league right now. I mean, he's impossible to cover one-on-one. I don't think there's any debate about that. He tops the league in receiving yards gained per route run, and that was still with a little bit of a foot issue. Who's the other kid? Taylor Gabriel. He's coming on now. You know, you got a capable tight end in Toalolo. You got two great backs in Freeman Tevin. What's his last name? I'm not going to remember. I'm going to have to look him up now. I want to say Tevin Campbell, and I know that's wrong.
I want to say Tevin Campbell, like it's not Campbell.
But it's because they have Devondre Campbell at linebacker also. They got a fast linebacking core, Deion Jones, Devondre Campbell. And I think, you know, Matt Ryan certainly helps in that equation. Also, they're just loaded. And a lot of young talent, particularly on the defensive side of the ball. So I think an experienced offense with a scheme, you know, that may tweak and change a little bit with Shanahan
right.
not there anymore. So that'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. Good offensive line. You know, I mean, they get the center from, you know, Cleveland last year, Alex Mack. You know, they got Lavitre there still.
They're loaded. I mean,
across
that
the
roster
board.
Looks great across the board. And
across the board.
You know, I mean, if you run the ball 20 times in the second half, who knows? You might be saying that the Atlanta Falcons are Super Bowl champions, but we know how that turned out. But, again, if you just look at what's on paper, they are definitely the best-built roster in the NFL currently.
So, speaking of best rosters, here is number three for you for real news, fake news. The 1991 Washington Redskins are the best team in the past 30 years. Real news or fake news?
Only because I saw the article. I'm going to say it is real. I disagree with the rankings. I think I would probably put some teams up there. I mean, but that was a very formidable team. I mean, you know, you had a great offensive line. You had great quarterback play out of it. You had great running back play. I mean, their defense got after guys, flat out got after guys.
Yeah, they had Wilbur Marshall from the 85 Bears playing linebacker for them at that point in time, I think. Charles Mann was a veteran. You know, you had some big dudes on that defense. And then you had Darryl Green, like an all-world corner.
Played for 20 seasons and still could run a 4.3 at 40 years old. Like yeah. That's amazing in itself, that 40-year-old guy, because I'm not running a 4.3, not coming close to a 4.3. Even if I was in the best shape of my life, I'm not hitting that at 40. But he played for a long time at a high level. That team was loaded. I don't know if I put them as my best team over the last 30 years. I mean, but they would definitely be in the top five for me.
The thing that I get hung up on is the quarterback. Because Mark Rippon was there, and then he was gone.
Right.
And they won three Super Bowls with three different quarterbacks. So, you know, to me, certainly it was a well-rounded roster. It was a deep roster in all three phases. And part of me wonders, is it because of that you could be successful with just about any quarterback? Because Theismann won one, Doug Williams won
yes.
one, and then Rippon won one. So What does that say about the quarterback, though?
I think it says that the guys around him were that good, and the scheme that they ran was that good, and their defense was top-notch. And again, you know, we always talk about defensive play and making sure that defense can be there and bail you out of situations. And their defense did that all season long. And their offense put up points. They ran the ball very well. But, again, it started up front with the O-line. Rippon played well that season. And they got to the Super Bowl, won it. I mean, it was one of those things that you just like, I don't know if I could say that they were better over all the teams you get to pick and choose from.
Better than, like, Bill Walsh's 84 Niners team. I think they went, 15-1 that
year?
Yeah,
I don't know if I can put them over that. I mean, they were amazing. I mean, and now we're going off our point differential and how well the defense played.
Don Shula's Dolphins in the early 70s. I mean, they weren't
undefeated.
They certainly weren't exciting, but they were
undefeated.
No, but they
won. Undefeated.
I mean, pick a Belichick championship team in New England.
What about one of those Pittsburgh teams? You know,
yeah, the 70s. Yeah, Chuck Knoll's Steelers, right. You know, even in the first Super Bowl team, you know, when all of those guys were still in their mid-20s.
Right.
And you're like, oh, boy, these guys are going to be good for a while.
I don't know. I mean, again, I think that was an excellent team. I don't know if I could put them number one. Maybe you could bounce them to two or three. But, I mean, you know, it's open for debate, and I think that's why I love the discussion because, you know, you start bringing up all your childhood memories. I mean, think about some of those great Cowboy teams that came up and when they won Super Bowl.
Yeah, you throw the Cowboys in there, too.
You've got a lot of teams to pick from. I mean, Jimmy Johnson Cowboys, they were amazing. They scored points. Their defense got after it. They played loose.
Pro Bowlers up and down the roster.
Up and down the roster. So, I mean, again, you can't really just say – I can't say definitively that the 91 Redskins was the best football team that I ever saw play.
Now, I will say this. We had Steve Tasker here in studio yesterday, and I during the break off air, I threw this at him because I had seen it, and he's like, look, he said, I don't want to say it. He said, but we played that team. He goes, they were really good. Like he said, they were really good. So I said, well, then do you agree that that's the best team in the last 30 years? And he said, I think they were. He said, so they beat Jimmy Johnson's Cowboys teams? I said, because they didn't in 92 or 93. And he says, well, it wasn't the same team. He said, the 91 team, he goes, I think they could have beaten those Cowboys teams if it was the same incarnation. You know, you fast right. forward and stick the 91 team in 92 or 93. He said, they probably could have beaten them. He thought they were that deep, that talented. Because I was like, you know, we're talking – Aikman hitting his prime now and, you know, Emmitt Smith and all the talent they had there, not only on offense, on defense. I mean, you had really good secondary. I don't know. I don't know.
He would know better.
Well, he played them.
He played them. So I would have to trust. I can't argue with that. I was a freshman. I was coming out of high school, about to go to Ohio State in 91.
He said, I know they had Mark Rippon at quarterback, and people think less of them probably because of that, because – you know, most of the greatest teams of all time have an outstanding quarterback, and they're one of, when you think about it, they're one of the few
right.
exceptions. I mean, Terry Bradshaw wasn't an all-world quarterback either. Maybe that's the only other guy that you would say fits into the same category, you know, as a Mark Rippon. He's still in the Hall of Fame, though.
Right.
You know, and Mark Rippon's not going to the Hall of Fame. He's not.
No, he's not. You're right. He's not.
So can you have a team that's the best team in the last 30 years with a quarterback who's not going to the Hall of Fame? I don't know if you can.
That's a tough – I mean, if you look at what they were able to do and what they put up and who they beat and how they beat them, you know, you have an argument. Again, I'm with you as I don't know if I can make them my number one overall. Steve Tasker is definitely in a different position because he got to watch that team. He got to see them.
They faced them.
He faced them, and they beat them handily.
Yeah.
So – again, he would have a better in a different perspective than maybe I would. I'm looking at it as a fan saying, you know, I thought, you know, I'm pulling for the Bills. I'm hoping that they win the Super Bowl, and it doesn't happen for them. So I'm looking at it like, hey, you know what? Again, that Washington Redskins team, although I think they were really good, I mean, can I put them over the Niners teams? Can I put them over a Cowboys team? I can't. But I was a younger kid. I was a younger fan growing up watching those teams.
Right. And here's the thing. Because and Casserly even admits that they don't get enough credit because they didn't have a Hall of Fame quarterback. That's his opinion. Our guys played great in those years, but they weren't Hall of Famers. I think it's the offensive line being the signature of the team, and not having the Hall of Fame quarterback means you don't get the recognition. We had a great team with some really good players. So I think, and what Steve was getting at when I talked to him about this, was that – from top to bottom on that roster. They didn't have some great players and then some good role players. It was his opinion that they had very good football players from 1 to 53 on that roster. He said even their special teams were really good. He said they had some really good players on special teams, too. And, you know, Steve went against those guys. Who are you to argue? And I think they had a good mix of young and old, too, that helped them, you know, the older guys were shepherding the younger guys, and they just all fit together really well. And so maybe you say this wasn't a team like the 92-93 Cowboys that had three or four Hall of Famers
right.
on it. You still have a Hall of Famer in Darryl Green
yes.
on that roster. Art Monk, Hall of Famer, on that roster. I'm trying to think of who else would be a Hall of Famer. Ton of Pro Bowlers.
Eight or nine Pro Bowlers
on that team. But not a ton of Hall of Famers. And I don't know. Do they go in the Hall of Very Good? I don't know. I just think that it's interesting to note that this is probably one of those few all-time teams that doesn't have the all-time quarterback to go with it.
Right. You're right.
Because whether you're talking about the Broncos back-to-back teams, you got
Broncos,
Elway.
Elway, Terrell Davis. You look at Shannon Sharp.
I mean, even the four-time AFC champion Bills have Kelly. So it's like an anomaly almost that here's this team, best team in the last 30 years. Well, who's the quarterback? Mark Rippon, huh? You know? And maybe the Giants teams that won two Super Bowls under Parcells. You know, Sims was the quarterback. He was hurt, didn't play in the second Super Bowl that, you know, Hostetler was able to win with the Giants there. But, you know, maybe that's another team that you could say was really good at that time. Maybe
but
not the best team in
Phil
the last
Sims,
30
though,
years.
So you
they did win one
hit.
With Phil Sims, and he was ridiculous in that game. I think he was 22 or 25 passing for, you know, 278 yards or something and two touchdowns. I mean, he played the perfect game in the biggest game. But maybe that's another guy that you say, you know, not a Hall of Fame quarterback, pretty darn close.
Right.
And that's a really good team. But, you know, you had Lawrence Taylor, a host of other guys. I mean, Harry Carson's in the Hall of Fame. Lawrence Taylor's in the Hall of Fame. You know, you got guys from that roster that, you know, were lights out football players. But it's the quarterback thing that I get hung up on with this team.
Yes,
best roster, you know. Mark Rippon. It's like, come on, Mark Rippon. And I can still see the Sports Illustrated cover.
I remember that because I was upset about that.
Was it Rippin' It or something was the Rippin' headline or something? And I don't know. I was never fond of that Washington team. And maybe it's personal bias. The thing that really chapped me in that article was Casserly was quoted as saying that it was his opinion that Gary Clark had to play in the shadow of Art Monk and Ricky Sanders, and because of that, his true potential was never realized in that offense. He was of the opinion that Gary Clark was a comparable receiver to Andre Reed. And that's where I said, okay, Charlie, now it's time to pump the brakes.
Slow down, fella. Right.
We got one final segment for you here on the John Murphy Show, as that is Real News and Fake News, presented by Yancey's Fancy, New York's Artisan Cheese. Marlon Kerner, Chris Brown with you, back to wrap it up. Here on the John Murphy Show, presented by Napa Auto Parts from One Bills Drive, this is Buffalo Bills Radio.
This is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
And now, what have we learned from today's show?
Time for What Have We Learned, brought to you by Advanced Alarm, the preferred alarm and home theater provider of the Buffalo Bills. Well, the first thing we learned is we got a little bit more of a picture painted for us by CBS Sports' Jamie Eisenberg on the Bills' fantasy outlook on offense for 2017.
I think if you get, you know, 13-plus games from Sammy Watkins with what he's capable of, with Zay Jones hopefully, you know, becoming a playmaker for them right away, and then whatever else they get from that receiving core, the offense should be great. You know, I got a chance to talk to Demaryius Thomas, who played for Rick Dennison in Denver at the Pro Bowl. Asked him about, you know, the offense in Buffalo, and he said, yeah, it's a great offensive plan, and certainly they set up the pass with the run, and that's a great situation for what you guys have with Buffalo.
We also learned a little bit about the American Flag Football League, a new upstart league founded by Jeff Lewis, who was a guest on the program, and He explained how his son's flag football games were what inspired him to get this thing off the ground.
And I noticed that their flag football games were becoming very entertaining just on their own. Not so much just because they're your kids and you care about your kids, but that just as the flow of the game and the action that was taking place, that they were interesting to watch, and much more so than other sports certainly played by kids that age. And so that's really where the idea kind of started.
And Marlon's ready to set up his own team right now. He's sending out texts, sending emails here during the break. What do you got? How many guys you got? You got people on board already? You going to jump in that tournament?
I got about 10 guys right about now ready to go.
10 guys. Yeah, I wonder how many guys you would need. It's 7-on-7. So you would think you probably need, you know, you're going to need some subs. Think 10 would do it?
10? Maybe 12.
Maybe 12. All right. Well, listen, Marlon, I thank you. Good luck with that project, by the way. Let me know how it turns out if you get in the tournament. Thanks for joining us here today and pitching in. We appreciate it.
Thanks
I'll be back
me.
Tomorrow with Steve Tasker to round out the week here on the John Murphy Show. The Entercom board op was Derek Kramer. Production assistance provided by J.J. Torito, George Blas, Jeff Koltenak, Thomas Hollander. Your executive producer is Jay Harris. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow here on the John Murphy Show.